Everyone, welcome to the Joint Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness, a subcommittee on serious events. So we're very serious in this room this morning. Good news is that it's May the 23rd, and it feels like January outside.
Exactly.
And so welcome, everyone. The first subject we're going to be discussing, well, everyone knows everyone at this table, so I won't introduce you, but this subcommittee will be meeting in Portland pretty soon, right? We are going to Portland. All right, we're going to do it. And that one, we're going to be looking at some very serious events. But today, we're talking about an issue I think that probably is getting more publicity than anything else, and that is this idea of pandemic infections, you know, spreading throughout the world. With transportation the other day coming back on an aircraft from Louisville, Kentucky, I was sitting there thinking, you know what? This is probably the biggest transporter disease in the whole wide world. Mm. Because I noticed as the further we flew, the more people were coughing on that aircraft. Mm-hmm. So with that, Madam Committee Administrator, do we have anything to say here, or should we?
No, I think we're about to begin.
All right. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed, and we thank you for being here this morning.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Can you all hear? I can hear I'm...
A little closer. That
okay, I can move it closer as well. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the manager of the Communicable Disease Preparedness Program in Oregon at the Oregon Public Health. And I'm here on behalf of Dr. Susan Allen, who's our public health director, who was not able to be here today. What I thought I would do is to give a little bit of a PowerPoint presentation, because I think it really illustrates some of the issues with pandemic influenza, and then briefly discuss our capacity to respond to all types of emergency, and include a little bit on gaps in public health resources. And then I think you all had asked also for some information about diseases in developing countries that might pose a threat to us.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Well, just one second. Judith, can we drop the lights too for the PowerPoint?
Absolutely.
Okay. While we're waiting for that, her to do that, we have the last main meeting of the committee. We took the video and took it back to cable access, and it was really amazing, very, very, I think, important video for folks to see. So we're hoping the same thing comes out of this, is that fully inform people what, you know, what we're facing and what they can do. Go ahead and proceed.
Okay.
So thanks.
Oops, that was clearly not the right thing to do. So pandemic influenza has frightened people for quite a while. This is a picture from the newspapers back in 1918, when the last very large pandemic was. And, of course, it's been in the news lately, too, and we have lots of concerns that we might be about to relive this. So what is influenza? It's a viral infection of the nose, throat, and lungs, and it's very spread very easily from people, primarily by coughing. And we have annual epidemics every winter time from December through March, and that's, of course, why we encourage everybody to get their annual flu shots. It is not, by the way, generally the gastroenteritis or the viral infection. I think you've all been hearing about norovirus infections that are occurring right now. There is no such thing as the stomach flu. Influenza is really a respiratory infection. And each year in Oregon, we have several hundred deaths due to influenza, just the annual type. So avian influenza, why should we worry about the bird flu? Well, one of the things is that it makes flu more confusing. Our annual influenza and flu shots, people get confused. Why are we now concerned about bird flu? It really does cause a huge problem for the agricultural industry, particularly chicken growers. And what we're concerned about is that the bird flu may provide the genetic material to start the next human influenza, which is what I'll be talking more about. So I'll discuss a little bit about avian flu, both the animal disease and the human disease that's happened recently, and then pandemic influenza, both the history and biology, and then end with a few of the planning issues that we've been dealing with. So the influenza is a virus, and there are really two antigens or proteins that occur on the coat of this, which are what is the helps us to get immunity to it. And there's something called the neuraminidases and the hemagglutinins. And so the flu changes each year. This is part of the problem. We have to get an annual flu shot, and each year we're trying to predict which are going to be those proteins on the surface. And most of the time we're pretty good, but we aren't always. What we do is to look at what the flu strain is that's circulating right now in Australia and in China or parts of Asia to see what we might be affected with. Now, this slide shows here that for these hemagglutinins, there are three types, H1, 2, 3, that affect humans. The reason I put this up here is that you can see there's overall 15 different types of these proteins. Birds get affected by all of them. You can see there are pictures of a pig up here, as well as seals and horses. There are other animals who get it, and I think we all recall the swine flu scare back in the 70s when I was in college that didn't materialize, but there was a huge fear, and it's because the swine flu, as you can see, can also spread to humans. At that point, it did not, luckily. Now, similarly, just another of these neuraminidases, just the surface proteins, but you can see humans are affected by three of them, whereas birds are essentially affected by all. So I think part of the point is there's lots of influenza out there, lots of different types. Birds carry all the types. Other animals are affected by a few of them, and then occasionally these cross over to people. Now, when we talk about bird flu, actually not all bird flu is harmful to birds. There are two main types, and you can see this is the H5N1 that we're concerned about, but here's H1 types that are considered to be low pathogenicity. That means the birds don't get sick. They may have the virus, but it really doesn't cause any problems for them at all. And then there's the highly pathogenic strain, and those are the ones that we're seeing now that kill large amounts of birds, and occasionally these highly pathogenic strains get into people, but not frequently. Not all birds succumb to flu. Some of the migratory aquatic birds, once again, while they may be reservoirs and they may have the infection, they may not be sick by it. So and studies have shown that about 30% of birds may be infected at any given time, even though they don't look sick at all. In birds, it can cause an intestinal infection. Unlike humans, I said for us it's primarily lungs. For birds, it can be in the intestines. And so once again, that's contact with bird feces. Close contact with animals is how some people get infected with these bird strains. Now, I'm showing this slide. There's a lot of detail here, but since 1983, you can see there's been a whole range of avian flu outbreaks in poultry. And with each of these, there's different pathogenicity of the strains, but you can see there have been millions of birds that have been killed or culled in order to limit the spread, primarily as a problem to agriculture. And several of these, while we hear about the ones in Asia, certainly, several of them have occurred here in the United States, in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, in Delaware, in Texas, and most recently there was the H7N3 strain affected birds in British Columbia, so very close to Oregon. Now, occasionally, these bird flus jump species. People who have very close contact become infected. The H7N7, once again, those are the proteins on the surface. In 2003, in the Netherlands, there were 89 cases of human disease, and one person died. That outbreak didn't go any further. And once again, in British Columbia, in 2004, there were 5 human cases, but no deaths. You can see the H9N2, just a different strain, and Hong Kong in 1999, 2 mild cases, and in 2003, another case. And I think you all recall that's when there were millions of birds in Hong Kong that were killed. Now, the H5N1, that's the current strain that we're so concerned about with bird flu, and that's what's been making the news. That is actually not... It's not all that recent. It's been around for about 10 years. It was first seen in 1997 in Hong Kong. They had 18 human cases of it, 6 deaths. And you can see here in 2003, 3 cases, and then in 04, 05, 120. And this past year, and I just pulled these data yesterday, but there have been 217 cases and 123 deaths. So once again, that's the reason that the bird flu has been making the news lately. Now, this is what we call an epidemic curve. It just shows the seasonality or the distribution of these the bird flu cases for the past 3 years. And what you can see here is that there's a peak in the wintertime, and then it drops off again and goes away. And then there's another peak in the wintertime and drops off. And, in fact, currently our cases are starting to drop off. The avian flu cases we may not be seeing anymore, H5N1, over the summertime. Fewer birds have been infected, fewer people. But that doesn't mean it's gone away. It may come back this next winter, just the same as our annual influenza comes back in the winter. This is a map that shows the distribution. Obviously, Southeast Asia has been hit the hardest, but I think you're all aware that it has been spreading westward, first to Turkey. I think there was two cases in Iraq, cases in Egypt, and we're concerned that it may be spreading further to the Western Hemisphere as well. This slide shows how we might be concerned that it's spreading to us. How would this get here? And this slide shows the migratory patterns of birds. There could be both wild birds that are spreading it, but there's also a fair amount of importation, exportation of poultry as well between countries. So could this bird flu possibly be spread either by wild birds or domestic birds or some combination? I think we have pretty clear guidelines here in the United States against importation of birds from Southeast Asia, but other parts of the world there is a fairly large traffic in agricultural products. Okay, so a little bit about human flu. Again, it causes fever, often sudden, and usually people are systemically ill. Chills, shaking, generally feel bad, headaches, muscle aches, those things I think we're all familiar with, unfortunately. It causes respiratory symptoms, runny nose, sore throat, cough. Now, occasionally, I said there is no such thing as the stomach flu, but occasionally influenza will cause some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, particularly in children, so they may not have the same symptoms that adults usually have. And, of course, what we're also concerned about are the complications, bacterial pneumonia that may come afterwards, and that's the most common cause of death related to influenza is the pneumonia that happens afterwards. Encephalitis is an infection of the brain, and then Reye syndrome as well. These are complications. Luckily, the last two are rare, but once again, pneumonia is not all that rare, unfortunately, and does cause a significant number of deaths each year. It is spread primarily by coughing. The incubation period is from 1 to 3 days. Now, this is going to be important when we get to planning. But some asymptomatic shedding does occur. So some people, when they've been exposed while they're incubating the organism before they become sick, may actually be able to spread it to others. And so that's one of the questions about, do you isolate people who've then had contact with someone who's ill, because you don't know if that person themselves is going to get ill. Droplet spread is important, but it's also possible that contaminated articles, so for example, you cough in your hand, you touch a doorknob, the next person who touches a doorknob and then moves the hand to the face might be a way to spread. That's particularly something we're concerned about in daycares, that kids have a lot of hand-to-mouth behavior. And you were talking about airplanes, Mr. Chair, so airborne, and there have been clusters that have occurred on airplane flights. And certainly that is a lot of people sitting very close together for a long period of time. So we have a few public health interventions that we can do. We vaccinate, particularly those at highest risk, but we like to encourage everyone to get a flu shot. Those most likely to transmit to high risk, so healthcare workers, even though they're younger. And one of the things that we also like to push is that otherwise healthy adults, it's important to get vaccinated so you don't lose that work time, but even children who then can spread it, even though they themselves don't become sick, they can become the sort of reservoir, being able to spread it to their grandparents who are more likely to become ill. There are a few antiviral medications you can take after you've been exposed, but the number of these is decreasing, unfortunately. You've all heard about Tamiflu. That is still effective. What we used to use, amantadine and ranitidine, in nursing homes, those two, the virus is now it has become resistant to those, and so we can't use those. They're not recommended anymore from CDC. And then infection control. Once again, I mentioned washing hands a lot. It's not a very exciting intervention, but it does seem to work. I show this because of the annual process with manufacturing flu vaccine. When we talk about the pandemic, we're hoping there'll be a vaccine. This is just our annual. In the summer and fall of the previous year is when we start to see what's circulating, and then it takes a full year before we actually get the vaccine in production and being able to put into the arms of people who need it. So you can see it starts in January, and then it needs to get into embryonated eggs, and then it gets isolated, et cetera. So once again, this diagram is to really show you that a vaccine, even when people say it can be developed, it is a very, very cumbersome process. And every year it's a cumbersome process, which is part of the reason a couple of years ago we had a flu vaccine shortage, because one of the manufacturers had problems with the process, and so we said that we can't import that in the United States, the Chiron vaccine, and we were down then. We were down by about half.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had written my question down for the end, but since you're here, I hope you don't mind. Since the feds will not be involved on the state level in terms of helping with vaccines, how do we plan to secure vaccines to handle those that, in the unlikely event or the likely event that we get it here, number one, and will budgetary constraints be a factor into how fast we gear up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I'm not sure I can answer all those questions. I think with vaccine, that's going to be developed at the federal level. We don't have any vaccine manufacturer here. When we had the vaccine shortage a couple of years ago, there is a federal distribution process. It comes through the Centers for Disease Control, was helping us to allocate vaccine, oh, and I say us, I mean the public health community, to all states to ensure that vaccine was distributed to all states. My understanding at that time, and I'm not with the immunization program, so I can't provide you with all the details, but we can get back to you with those. But my understanding was that budgetary constraints were not the problem. It really was that we were lacking in vaccine.
Mr. Chairman, I just visited the Colorado legislature, and the concerns that they had was that, and I'd like for this to go on record for this committee, that unless states have early entry to the federal government in terms of their intent for this influenza shot or preventions, is going to be first come, first serve. And I would like a letter going to our governor asking him to make the intent known in the likely or unlikely event we were to have such a disease here. I especially worry about those farmers who do have so many birds on their farms or companies of this nature. And I think that people who might not be on a farm but have some contact in some way, whether it's from the grocery store when we're transmitting the birds and that kind of stuff, that when it does hit, I mean, it hits fast, as in the Hong Kong case, because did you notice the progression and the number of people that were affected by it? So, Mr. Chairman, with this committee sending a letter to the chair asking that the governor of this state make such intent known, I think would be in keeping with what the Emergency Preparedness Committee is all about.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Judith is making a note on that. I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
Maybe you can get with her afterwards and we can talk about what you learned, you know, from Colorado.
Okay.
I think one of the messages that keeps coming out is we just heard from the FEMA report just recently, and that was the states are going to have to take care of themselves.
Absolutely.
That's very wise counsel.
Right.
I just mentioned antivirals. There are two classes of them. The first class can't be used anymore. Tamiflu are the neuraminidase inhibitors. The problem with Tamiflu is we don't actually know how well it's going to work against bird flu. So a lot of the discussion about that and how much we should have in stockpile, we need to remember that it may not even work all that well. So infection control measures, avoiding contact with sick people, mask and eye protection, hand hygiene, I mentioned washing hands, and having some respiratory etiquette in clinics so that if you have, and they try to do this already, but if you have well child checks, you want those first thing in the morning and then to have the sick patients come in later during the day so you're not having one coughing patient, coughing all over a well patient who's there for an annual visit. Immunization of healthcare workers and caregivers, and really encouraging people to stay home when they're sick. I think we have a very strong work ethic in this country that, you know, if you just have a mild cough or whatever, you're feeling not good, you should come to work anyway. And in fact, then you put others close to you at risk. And I think we need to switch that around, saying you don't feel good, I don't want you next to me. Maybe you can telecommute from home and answer your emails, but... So just a little bit about what happens with influenza drift. I talked about that. The flu virus changes every year, and it changes in very small ways. And this is illustrated by these sands. The sand dunes are still there. If you came back, took this picture a few weeks later or the next year, you'd see different lumps, but essentially it would look like sand dunes. So that's the reason that it requires this small change in the genetic material each year. But shift is more like an earthquake. It's a major change, and that usually happens when some non-human virus, like a bird virus, then starts to infect a person, and we've seen that throughout Asia. Then the concern, though, is if that person is also infected with a human flu virus, can those two reassort so that the bird flu can be spread person to person? So the current H5N1 has not been spread person to person, but that's the real concern, is that's how a pandemic's going to start. It's not just from the birds giving it to people, it's from it then changing so that people can spread it to other people. Okay, just a little bit about the 1918 flu pandemic. It was the most deadly outbreak of an infectious disease. There were 20 to 40 million people who died worldwide, 500,000 in the U.S. 20 to 40% of the population became sick, and a very high death rate, more than 50 times normal. And what was unusual with this, as opposed to a normal flu season where it's young and the elderly, in fact, it was young adults who were primarily susceptible. Here's just a quote from the 1918 Spanish flu. 2 hours after admission, they have mahogany spots over the cheekbones. After a few hours later, cyanosis from the ears spreading over the face, only a matter of a few hours before death. Very, very rapid between onset and death. And I think this is an unusual characteristic that we don't see this in the usual flu season. Those deaths, still, once again, it's a secondary pneumonia, and it tends to happen over a period of a week or so rather than hours. Just to put it into context, the war dead during World War I, 126,000 in the U.S., flu dead during that 1 year, 500,000. So it was a much bigger problem than World War I itself. And part of the reason is that we had a lot of young people in trenches and in barracks very, very close together. Back to the airplane analogy, people who are then sick and coughing and are in very close proximity to each other in conditions that possibly are already taxing they're stressful and taxing their immune system. Once again, just in context, the Spanish flu, that's the 1918 flu, killed more people than World War I. These are our death rates. So World War I, the Civil War, and World War II. Huge problem. This curve just shows that in a normal season, which is similar to that, the dotted line here, 1911 through 1915, the young and the very old are primarily at risk for dying. But in 1918, you see that peak, the black line there in the 25 to 34-year-olds. And so that's the concern, that it's going to be a different group who also gets sick. There have been other pandemics. We hear about 1918. There was actually a pandemic back in 1957 and another in 1968 that caused high or excess mortality, but not on the same level as 1918. But once again, this was due to some reassortment in the flu virus. And so pandemics do occur with some regularity. We aren't able to predict exactly how severe they're going to be. All right, I'm worried that I'm going to run out of time here. So what could start a pandemic? I illustrate this slide because we probably have a very different relationship to animals here in the United States, other than poultry farmers, let's say, but then people in other parts of the world. One of the reasons that we're seeing so many cases in Southeast Asia, I think, is that there are live bird markets. People may have just a handful of chickens in their own house. Very, very close contact between people and animals. And once again, if one of these people also has human flu, thus the annual strain, the question is, if they became infected, could it be reassorted? So there are two ways this reassortment can happen. We can get it directly for the bird, or a pig itself could be infected with both a bird strain and a human strain, and it gets reassorted to then infect a person. Once again, that's why we were concerned about the swine flu back in it was the mid-70s, I'm trying to remember, because it was when I was in college, and that didn't happen. Okay, so pandemic flu planning. There are a lot of plans that are happening. They're on the sort of larger level, we have, or government level, I should say, we have global pandemic flu plans. WHO has a plan. Within the United States, Health and Human Services has a federal plan. We also have a plan here in Oregon, and local health departments need to have their own plans, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Hospitals and hospital regions, healthcare regions, also are in the process of doing pan flu planning. Now, some of the challenges with it include that there's a very short incubation period. I mentioned that 1 to 3 days, which makes it hard to control. If it were larger or longer incubation period, you could isolate people during that time and get a hold of them. But when it's a very short incubation period, it may spread before we know it. The asymptomatic shedding that I mentioned, people may be spreading the disease before they themselves are sick. Having adequate hospital capacity. No pre-existing immunity. That's why we need to get a flu shot every year. The virus changes, and the immunity wanes as well. You don't get lifelong immunity like you would with, let's say, chickenpox. The rapid, frequent travel, I think, and you mentioned that too, any of these diseases, excuse me, is just a plane flight away or two. We can literally get to any part of the world within 24 or 48 hours, which is the incubation period of pandemic flu. So it would be very easy, and we saw that with the SARS epidemic as well. There is no vaccine ahead of time. There are limited use of the antiviral medications. We're not sure about the value of community controls, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So when we've done planning here at the state of Oregon, one of the things that we've done is to look at what a scenario would be. What is it that we're planning for? The annual flu season, of course, we're concerned about that, but we know how to get vaccine into people, and we have adequate hospital beds, et cetera. With a pandemic, we're estimating that in Oregon, and you'll remember that the figures back in 1918, 20% to 40% of the population, so here in Oregon, it's about 30%, is once again a scenario. The differences between the moderate and severe are not the number of overall people who get sick, 1.17 million in both cases, and outpatient visits, but rather the number of people who are hospitalized increases tenfold between a moderate scenario and a severe scenario, and that's really where we're going to have trouble with hospital beds. You see intensive care unit beds and capacity, ventilators, that's been one of those medical equipment that we've been concerned about, and then you see the death rate here over a tenfold, and even the moderate scenario is about tenfold what we have as an annual death rate in Oregon usually. Now recall, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, but ventilators are medical equipment. We're also concerned about having people to operate the ventilators. So it's not just a question of the equipment, it's a question of staffing.
That's going to be one of my questions. And the other one is, since so many deaths occur as a result of being in hospitals where it's highly infectious in many instances, what are hospitals doing to gear up for this? And what are those frontline responders doing?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter. Excellent questions. I think that it's fair to say we're relatively early in the planning process, that is, all of us. And there need to be plans at all levels, including at the hospital level. One of the key issues really does have to do with what we call surge capacity to take care of patients, surge capacity to deal with the bodies. We need to have a mortuary plan. One of the things that I think is going to be very difficult for us to do is to figure out how to prioritize services as well. I think people who've been in the military and medics at the time of war understand the concept of triage. You look at patients, you see who you can actually help and who has a possibility of surviving and who, in fact, is too far gone, and that's a triage process. We're not used to doing that. In the civilian sector, we don't triage. People who are severely ill, we bring them into the hospital and we do whatever we can. And I'll be mentioning this a little bit more. The issue or the term we use, the jargon is alternate standards of care and alternate sites of care. So if I get sick right now, severe respiratory illness, I want you to take me to the hospital and maybe put me on a ventilator. Well, at some point, are we going to have to make a decision that I'm too far gone or somebody else, or if you have two people, you're going to triage the sicker one to an alternate, or you're going to call them and say you need to stay home because you're spreading it. These are things that are really unheard of here, but that's part of the very, very difficult discussion that needs to go into it. I'll talk a little bit more about the planning in a minute, but our feeling is not that we can make all these decisions now, but rather we need to figure out what the process is and who needs to be around the table when those decisions are made.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to isolate this question, because it's one of the other things that we found also, and that is that hospitals have not been been at the table of a lot of this conversation. So what I'd like for this committee to do is send a letter to the chair, and again, we're asking these first-line responders to come before this committee and talk about their planning and their preparation, because it would appear to me that, along with my first question, was since the feds will not be involved, what are we using in terms of preparation, implementation, and distribution? Those are three issues that are going to be so important to this process that we must be able to do, because you can't wait to the last minute to decide who stays home, who's in the most need, and things. I don't mean to scare anybody along these lines, but I understand that it's been so hard to diagnose some of these cases in terms of influenza that nobody's prepared, nobody's mm-hmm. ready. And so I think hospitals, as first-line responders along those lines for the most severe that are attacked by this, especially when it gets into the lungs, that we need to have something.
I think that would be, we have the chairperson here, one of them, and the question is, we need to bring in the association, the hospital, you know, those type of folks, and ask them, you know, are you, how organized are you guys? And that leads me to my question, if Senator, if you're
please
finished, do we have the authority to tell someone you will stay home and isolate yourself, or do we have the authority in law to isolate them? Because we're only in here every 2 years, and that was one of the questions that Judith and I talked about, is what type of authorities do we have to manage that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator. Let me see. There were a lot of questions there. One had to do with hospital planning, and actually, we have two grants that we are from the federal government, one from the Centers for Disease Control, and one from HRSA, healthcare financing group, to talk about planning. And the HRSA planning is actually done; it's hospital-based planning, and it's done in regions around the state of Oregon. And so, there's been a fair amount of planning that has happened at the hospital. We include those in our planning process in state public health. So we have an advisory group that includes hospitals as well as local public health, as well as some emergency responders, the Oregon Emergency Management, et cetera. There are a lot of groups who are helping to advise us. We're going to be having a full-scale pandemic influenza exercise to look at these plans and how well these all dovetail, and that's going to be November 1st and 2nd. And leading up to that, we have multiple other exercises, what we call, but both tabletops where I give this kind of orientation to people they talk about. So if I do this, what are the different parties going to do? What are agency responses as well? So those are things that we are in the process. We're very much trying to include them. We do have a training plan for pandemic influenza that includes a strong component dealing with emergency responders and first responders and what they should do. They're clearly high on the list for getting a vaccine if a vaccine is available. That's a big if. High on the list for potential control measures, because we know that if they're scared and are staying home, the whole system will fall apart. I mean, we need to ensure that people who are in a position to need to respond are going to be able to do that.
Let me interrupt you for a second, because that was one issue in our first meeting that really disturbed me when we heard we had first responders saying, look, you have to understand that we're going to take care of our families and ourselves first, and we'll get to you later. And when I went back and reviewed the tape to make sure that I had remembered that correctly, Now, that was good counsel for all of us to say you were we better be self-sufficient. But on the other thing, the thing that worried me the most was, do they have the equipment to protect themselves, not only the shots, but the gloves and the mask and everything else? Do we have an adequate supply of those kind of things on hand to protect the responders during the period of dealing with this outbreak?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do think that in terms of masks and gloves and basic equipment, we do have it. Now, the problem with masks, however, is that there's a varying degree of how well they work. You can certainly get a mask that protects you from particles if you're sanding or, painting a room at home. That doesn't work for influenza. There's something called an N95 mask that has to be fit to someone's face. So if a man has any facial hair, it won't work. If somebody changes, you know, weight, either gains weight or loses weight, it doesn't fit. So there's a fitting process that needs to happen. There's also something called a papper. It's a positive airflow device that you put on. But that sort of looks like the moon suit, and that might be very frightening to people. So I think what we need to do is to come up with some guidelines. What we really do need to protect the first responders as well as hospital workers, as well as, you know, other people who are involved with the pandemic. We need to assure them that they can be protected to the extent possible. And I think that's the big if here, is that we really can't, you know, with a lot of this, we can't guarantee anything. I have high hopes for a vaccine, but I don't know that that's going to happen. And I already mentioned the issues with the Tamiflu. You can take that prophylactically beforehand, not just after you're sick, but if you have two people that you're going to prioritize, one who's severely ill and could benefit from this, not die, and you have someone who's well, who you're worried about becoming infected, who do you give the medication to? I think those are the kinds of things that are going to be difficult for us as a society, really, to deal with. We're going to have to make hard choices about, because certainly in medicine, what we tend to do is to treat the ill before we work at making sure that someone else gets the prophylactic drug. But that may not be the case in this. We may need to be able to ensure. And actually, part of our plan, and the federal plan as well, does have a list of priority groups, including treating the ill is higher on that priority list than the prophylaxis. So there has been some discussion as to what those groups would be. And part of that we've included in the discussions, medical ethicists, et cetera. But it is, these are very complicated issues. There is no easy answer.
Mr. Chair?
Could I finish following that question, then we'll get to Senator Gordley. Does anyone track the total quantity of protective equipment that's out there? In other words, for example, I have the Gempler's catalog, and I open up the Gempler's catalog, and it has all of the different, you know, protective equipment you're talking about. And we're talking about for agricultural use. And you have a series of, a category of all of the filtration type units that you can put on. And basically, you have those in inventory, they're sealed, you select the proper one, screw it on your unit, and mount your protection equipment. Do we have any idea, and I think that's what Senator Carter was getting at, from the standpoint of the state, as to how much equipment's out there? We're going to be asking our pharmaceutical folks in a little bit, how much is out there? If this happened tomorrow, where are we? And does anyone track that? In other words, how many hospitals have, what police departments have, what...
Mr. Chair, the short answer is no. We live in a capitalist economy where people order stuff directly from the company. We don't track medical supplies. There is no sort of state system for tracking. Now, that's the short answer. The longer answer is that obviously this has been a big issue around pandemic response, and so one of the things that we've been interested in is how many ventilators are there. Now, that's an easier piece of equipment to think about. Mm-hmm. They're both sort of your standard ventilators, and they're disposable ventilators. And we started to ask hospitals, how many do you have and how many do you have access to? Because, once again, we don't go there, and if they're many different, and I don't know the details about ventilators, but if there are many different supply companies, we don't get that information directly from the supply companies. It's easier to get it from the hospitals themselves. The second part to that, though, as I mentioned already, is you don't just need the ventilator. You need someone who can not only plug it in but turn it on and suction and do a lot of, you know, intubate people and do it. And so the staffing capacity is a problem. But we do not have any of that monitoring of what's happening with other medical equipment. Certainly I know that the Board of Pharmacy does tracking of controlled substances. So if you're looking at, you know, opiates or any of those controlled substances, they have a way of monitoring that. It's much harder to do that for all supply because people tend to order, and hospitals order from their supplier and who can give them the best deal at this point in time. There is something also, just one little piece, called the Strategic National Stockpile.
Right.
And that were we, pandemic flu is going to be different if it affects every state, but were we to have a disaster like they did in New Orleans or in the South, where we can call upon the Strategic National Stockpile. And we've had a number of exercises that have looked at dispensing that stockpile. It comes into an undisclosed location here because, once again, they're worried about terrorism, et cetera. But then how that gets distributed with the Department of Transportation sanitation, and the local health departments are the ones who set up dispensing sites or clinics, and we have exercised those and will be exercising them as part of the November PanFlu exercise. And the Strategic National Stockpile contains not only medications but other medical supplies. Now, that said, and we have heard from the federal government that in the event of a pandemic, every state can't be asking for the stockpile. We have some proportion that's been allocated to Oregon of the federal supplies, certainly of Tamiflu and other things, but it's clear that the feds will not be able to respond to every state at the same time, which is part of the reason that the handshake is you're on your own. Not quite. I mean, they're supportive with technical assistance, but realistically, and we can see that too, that the federal government is not going to be able to respond to Oregon over Washington or Idaho or New Jersey.
Just before we go to Senator Gordley, I'm going to talk to the committee right now on this, and I think this is something we need to look into. Do we need our own stockpile at a location that would be subject to distribution in an outbreak?
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment about that. The question is the stockpile of what? Certainly we're talking about medical supplies. In the case of Tamiflu, we have been concerned that it might not be effective and that we could spend a huge amount of money on medications that we don't yet know whether they're even going to be effective. And the second part of it is that, at least for the federal government, it's what's called vendor-managed inventory, but they actually rotate it, because if you keep IV fluids for 3 years, you don't want to put that in somebody's arm. So what they do is they keep it there for a year, they rotate it out, and they sell it and rotate it in, so that you're not then having everything expire at the same time and wasting a lot of money, et cetera. So once again, it's quite a it's a complicated process, as I'm learning.
Excellent. Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. A couple of thoughts here. I think it would be critical for this committee, our serious events subcommittee, and the full committee to participate in the exercise that's coming up in November. So if you could, at some point in your presentation, say more about that exercise, the components of the exercise, and where it will be taking place around the state, and how your thoughts about how this committee might participate in that event. I wanted to go back to the hospital piece just for a moment, too, before we get too far away. Hospitals are currently involved in a project using the funding that you mentioned earlier, HRSA funding, mm-hmm. and the other grant.
See, that's the CDC preparedness, right?
It's a special project to reach special populations, underserved, hard-to-reach populations in the various regions that make up our state. And in one particular region I could speak of that includes Multnomah County, in the event of pandemic flu, this project is looking at and has contracted with community-based organizations that can help us understand how particular populations might respond in the event of pandemic flu, and is helping us understand what the needs of those populations might be in the event of pandemic flu. And the specific populations include African American, African immigrant, Latino, Russian, Vietnamese, with materials developed in the various languages to reach out to those specific populations. So just wanted to add that note that there is that work going on with hospitals. And I think it's so the work that's going forward is so significant, Mr. Chair, that I would recommend that we invite representatives of the hospitals when they come to share with us mm-hmm. how that specific project is moving forward.
Okay. Sounds good.
I have another thought, but I'll save it to the end of this presentation.
Okay. All right. so the Oregon Pandemic Flu Plan, we've had a pandemic flu plan actually since 1999, but then the federal government released or re-released the federal plan in the fall of 2005, and so we've just finished revising our plan. And these are some of the areas that addresses what we call incident command structure, how the it's going to be managed. Communications, surveillance, are looking for cases or people who are ill, lab testing, hospital and healthcare systems we've been speaking about, vaccines and antivirals, community control measures, travel and workforce support. These are just some of the areas. This list, I should say, is not necessarily, it's what's in the plan now. I'm starting to understand that plans are never quite finalized. You finalize them and then you revise them as more information happens. So if more needs to be included, we certainly can. Just a little bit about each of these. The command structure is that public health will be the lead agency in pandemic flu. That doesn't mean we're going to obviously be the sole response agency, because we have to work very closely with emergency management, local health departments, fire, police, dispensing. There's a whole range. And then we've also mentioned communities themselves, hospital systems, community-based organizations, et cetera, to help implement the plan, or, you know, get actually to the people who are sick. We can provide subject matter expertise, coordinate between agencies to make sure we're not stepping on each toes, and also no one's falling through the gap. The decision-making process, and things change as a pandemic evolves. We may be making different decisions early on than we would later on. And certainly the resources, and that's what we've been spending a fair amount of time talking about, and how we actually get resources, scarce resources, into the hands of people who need them. Coordination of communication is really going to be key. It's going to be very difficult if one local health department or jurisdiction says we're closing all our schools now, and the next one says no, schools aren't, there's no transmission happening, and you're thinking, gee, these look exactly the same. So we really need to have similar messages coming from all the different people who are involved. Distributing fact sheets to medical community needs to know what we're doing as well, policymakers, as well as the public, and about what they can do to become protected and what their role in this is. And establishing a hotline, and we certainly have had hotlines. Once again, 2 years ago with the flu vaccine shortage, we established a hotline at the state public health that I think was quite well received.
Senator Carter?
What is your strategy, number one, to cross jurisdictional lines? When I went to visit Louisiana, this is one of the things that they said, that if you don't have jurisdictional communication or privilege before this happens, it is the thing that is so catastrophic. So I can't communicate to you enough as a state health department, how do you get jurisdictional approval to move throughout counties, the counties in our state, the regional jurisdictions. So let me say that with a loud, loud voice.
Well, let me follow up with this. Does the governor, it was back to my question before, does the governor have authority to say, okay, this is what action will be taken? Is there that emergency events type authority vested in the governor? If not, how should that be handled?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, these are very good questions, and I really wish that Dr. Susan Allen were here, because you know she's a lawyer as well as a physician and could answer this. We're in the process of doing right now what we call a public health law review. We have our assistant attorney general, the Department of Justice, is looking into what laws we have and whether they are adequate to protect people in all jurisdictions. So that is at the beginning of the process, but it's a train rolling down the track. I mean, it's something that I know Dr. Allen has felt very strongly we need to address. I think one of the things about the control measures is that in the case of SARS in Canada, it's the balance between, let's say, isolation and quarantine. People have to stay home. This has to happen. And the balance between that and civil liberties. Mm-hmm. And at least in the case of SARS in Canada, I think it was quite effective that people stayed home voluntarily. When they were told, we don't want you to spread it to others, we need you to stay home, people did that. And I think it's a lot easier to get people to do things with a carrot voluntarily than with a stick. That said, I do think we need to have the stick behind it so that we say to people, and if you don't do it voluntarily, here's the procedure that will happen. Once again, whether the governor has adequate control or ability to do this, I think the short answer is probably in an emergency. I would hope that he could do almost anything. That said, I don't know about the laws. I do know that Dr. Allen has some concern that they are not adequate. So that's a piece that we could certainly use.
But you can't. What Louisiana said, you can't do anything. They had to go. They had to wait, and that's why it made the governor and the mayor look so stupid.
Yeah.
Because they could not do anything. The feds were not there in time to give them override for doing it. So I would like Oregon to move smoothly and transitionally.
A plan in place.
That's exactly right. That does overrule jurisdictions so this can happen. And I'm going to put something else on your screen, and that is the very poor with not paid attention to. And I'm hoping that your plans will include those with no transportation, those have no alternative housing, and where do we go from here? Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair,
copious notes.
Yes, I know. Thankfully, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, one of the things that we have been working on is a memoranda of understanding. Now, counties have them with other counties, even for things like if they have. Certainly, we know about firefighting, and if you have a big conflagration in one county and the other, they can send fire trucks and it's covered. There are a number of counties that have been looking at this for public health as well. I know Benton County has them with Polk and Lynn. I don't think every county has it with every other county in adjacent borders, but clearly this idea of memorandum of understanding, I need help, I'll ask you, and that means in the future when you need help, we'll respond. So thinking about more as a, I would say, state public health workforce, and I don't mean state government, but I mean sort of broader community, not, well, I'm in my county and I'm only worried about my folks. So, and that memorandum of understanding that's also happening between states. So there was a meeting cross borders held, 2 weeks ago now, but in Bellingham, Washington, with Washington State and the Canadians. They were talking about those, but Oregon also attended, Dr. Allen and then Mike Harriman, who's our preparedness manager. And folks from Idaho, et cetera, to all talk about how these issues would work between states. Once again, the problem with the pandemic, I think, though, is certainly the example of a hurricane is a sudden event, and we do need to prepare for those as well. We're on a subduction zone. We could easily have a tsunami on the coast. So those kind of events could happen here. But with the pandemic, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to rely very much because we're going to be asking another county or jurisdiction that even though their problem isn't as bad as ours, they're still having a problem there. So I think some of the issues, not just can people do it legally, but if my workload on my desk is piling high, even though it's not as much of a disaster as yours, I still have to answer to my county commissioners or, you know, if you're in the local health department. So some of those issues, I think it would take at the state level up the governor, for example, saying we need, you know, all the employees from Morrow County, even though you have a few cases there, all of you need to come and help out, you know, Benton or DeShue or wherever else is having the problem. And I do not know that structure is currently in place. Right. I think it's more the, like I say, the memorandum of understanding.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. Are you familiar with the redefining readiness demonstration project? Redefining readiness?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm not.
I'm going to commend that study to you, and there's a short article about it in the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies journal, the March-April edition. One of the findings of the study, and again, it's around looking at flaws in emergency preparedness and preparedness for all manner, any type of emergency or disaster. One of the findings is that planners routinely develop instructions for people to follow without finding out whether it's actually possible for them to do so, or whether the instructions are even the most protective action for certain groups of people to take, which kind of picks up on the point that Senator Carter was making about making sure we're looking at the needs of vulnerable populations. And so I commend the study to you and would like to know your thoughts about it after you've had a chance to take a look at it, but would also like to know what is built into our planning efforts that allows us to look outside the box, think outside the box. What does that piece look like?
So, Mr. Chair,
and
Senator,
who are the people helping us think outside of the box?
Excellent questions. Clearly, with special populations, we are not where we need to be. We are at the very early stages. I know that we've been looking at the lessons from Hurricane Katrina and what was found in New Orleans, and this idea that people would self-evacuate, but if you have a car with gasoline, it seats five or six people, and you've got eight people, and who's going to want to choose whether you're leaving, grandma behind, or, are you leaving, which family member, and so on. Number of cases, people stayed, not because they didn't have any transit, but they didn't have adequate, and people tend to be concerned about taking care of their whole family, and clearly some of the assumptions we made about self-evacuation did not pan out. Clearly, in something like pandemic influenza, I could imagine people are sick at home, don't have transportation. What about their other medications? What about their diabetes medication? What about so the vulnerable populations, figuring out how we're going to get to those people, I think is that is a point well taken. Within the planning process, we have been working with our Office of Multicultural Health, who's been working with the community. Dr. James Mason, working larger. Once again, I really, if you will, don't want to defend where we are currently because we have not gotten as far as we need to. The issue of vulnerable populations, and I know you mentioned the different racial and ethnic groups, clearly in a pandemic, where poor people may be, there may be other special populations. We saw folks in, the elderly in nursing homes. So here they are in an institution, which could presumably take care of them, but still had no evacuation plans, and that elderly in nursing homes were particularly at high risk, even though you would think they're not homebound. They have access to some form of medical care, and clearly they were very hard hit during the hurricane.
And as a follow-up to this whole discussion around special populations, I recently met with the Commission for the Blind. They're beginning to look at this whole area of being prepared in the event of pandemic, flu, any kind of emergency, and so put them on your list of folks to be talking with and helping them think through how they can serve their population as well.
Yeah,
as your plans go forward.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that it really brings up the point that there isn't any one person, agency, organization responsible for planning. Clearly, and I showed on the slide, we have WHO, but they're talking about something done on a worldwide basis. We have a federal plan, but then the feds say, well, you're not going to be able to rely on us. So we have the State of Oregon plan, but to be frank, communities, there aren't enough of us at the state either who are going to be able to help every community, every business, every school. There are local health departments. They serve as the point people. But really, the resources at local health departments, that has been a huge problem. And we're talking about sort of gaps in resources, public health funding at the State of Oregon, and we've certainly got a lot of funding from these preparedness grants. But the majority of our funding comes from various federal grants, and we have some other funds. I think state general fund, we get about 7% for state public health. And local health departments, likewise, have continued to be cut back on. And so the resources at the local level, a number of those local health departments, particularly in rural counties, may be staffed by literally a handful of people, many of whom are part-time. I know that the health officers, Multnomah County has a full-time health officer, even the other metro ones, Clackamas and Washington, have half-time health officers. And some of the other counties, their health officer is literally 4 hours a month to sign standing orders and really isn't part of a public health system. So that's been kind of a problem. We've been lucky that we've been able to get as much federal planning dollars as we have, but we don't have the state funds. And part of the problem with having federal planning dollars is that we then are also answerable to the federal government. They say that you need to work on this, and that that's what we need to work on because that's where the money comes from. And so trying to leverage that to make sure that we address all the planning issues in our state, I think, is important. And once again, I speak not so much for state government, although I mentioned our budget, but clearly local health departments, many, many of them are hurting. And we see that in response to even some of our, quote, day-to-day outbreaks. You've been hearing about the norovirus in nursing homes and in schools that are happening now across the state. And, you know, in Clark County, Washington, a couple of deaths in these nursing homes. But the ability for public health to help out those nursing homes, to talk about what control measures they might put in place, is just is sorely limited.
I think that's okay. Yes.
As a follow-up to that, you know, Mayor Nagin said we had a plan in Louisiana. It wasn't that they didn't have plan on paper, but what happened was it was out beyond anything they could even imagine. I think that the thing that concerns me about memorandums of understanding, or back to Senator Carter's comment about how do you get the authority, in a case of pandemic flu or a crisis where people are dying all around and you're becoming temporary morgues, mm-hmm. and people are frantic over their families and it is hysteria, I'm wondering what we're doing to prepare people for the fact that they've got to be calm. People have to, whether it's with public health, somebody has to be in control here, almost like in war,
mm-hmm.
That's a lot of what happened in Louisiana. It was, we'll just bring them all to the center. Well, there was no food, no water, no way of taking care of it. But it was in hysteria and crisis. And I think we've got to somehow be realistic about not thinking, as Senator Gordley said, not thinking the way we always think about, well, now you and I just need to have an agreement here, when you're going to have thousands of people demanding that you do something for their family. So there's got to be some order mm-hmm. put into chaos. And is that kind of discussion taking place on educating the public?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, these are really good questions and very complex issues. I think one of the things that may be different, we're not necessarily in a hurricane region here in Oregon. So that doesn't mean we can't have an earthquake because we are in a subduction zone. But some of these scenarios, we can learn a lot from the hurricanes in the south. On the other hand, applying it all to pandemic flu, this is something that may unfold over a period of weeks or months as opposed to a single day. Now, that said, I don't actually disagree with the premise that people may respond in a very worried fashion, and people may be extremely nervous. I think in that scenario, we can learn a lot from the SARS epidemic, which unfolded over a period of a few weeks. It was one or two seasons, and then it actually died off. Now, I know that, at least in Toronto, they were very upset when the World Health Organization put a travel restriction, and a lot of people were very worried about that. But I do think that the response, that was one where there was no vaccine and there was no antiviral medication. They had a couple of hospitals where the cases were and were able to confine it pretty much to hospitals and healthcare workers who themselves were at risk, and then home isolation, and were actually able to control that epidemic through these sort of standard public health procedures that I had mentioned earlier. But the second part of the answer to your question is we do need to meet with all of the people who can respond beforehand. So that's one of the reasons that we work, for example, closely with the FBI right now and law enforcement. When there was the anti-terrorism conference in Portland back in December, I spoke at that, and we shake hands with law enforcement beforehand so they understand public health role is this, law enforcement is this, we're going to need your help, for example, if there are a lot of people coming to a point of dispensing or a clinic site wanting their antivirals. We need the Department of Transportation to get the medications to the places they need to get to. So part of these plans is to talk to people beforehand saying, this is a role I can take, but I don't know how to drive a truck. I can't get the medications there, but I can help figure out who needs to. So I think, and then the other part of that, of course, is exercise, so that during an exercise, we actually set up those clinics, and the ones we can have in November, we've gotten, we may be actually giving at a number of them the annual flu vaccine, so we can see how the clinic flow works, so we can see how all of those processes work were it to be a pandemic, so that people understand if you've done it a few times in the form of practice, then maybe it won't, havoc won't occur in quite the same fashion. So I do have high hopes that the planning process, and not just the plans, but talking with people, figuring out roles and responsibilities, and exercising the plans, will put us in better stead. I can't say that it will make it all run perfectly, because we can tell people, please don't panic, here are some tools for you, but you know, with the government, we're here to help you, may not be exactly what everybody wants to hear.
But you know, picking up on that point, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, it occurs to me that we're very fortunate in this state to have a governor. I think about what he's doing today in saying farewell to our National Guardsmen mm-hmm. who are going off to mm-hmm. Afghanistan, and his personal commitment that he's made to them, to their families, on behalf of all Oregonians. We have a governor who's very personable, very no-nonsense. What I would like to see, and this goes back to a point that Senator Berger is trying to make here, is, you know, we need something like a emergency preparedness day that's also
focused
on...
You just stole my thunder. That's just what I was going to say. Great mind.
We're all up here.
It should be July the 4th because we celebrate independence and preparedness.
We're all sitting here thinking the same thing, but I'm thinking the governor uses his bully pulpit mm-hmm. to declare Emergency Preparedness Day and issues a proclamation. The proclamation lists all those things that are about citizens taking personal responsibility to do the things that they need to do in order to be prepared in their homes, in their workplace, in school. It's those basic common sense things. It's about having the food, having the water, having your medications, looking after your neighbor, but having the governor be the person who starts to talk about this with the Oregon community mm-hmm. before we have the disaster or the pandemic flu. And again, I just think that our governor is the perfect person to do that. And you had a suggestion earlier before our hearing started, Dr. Hedberg, about our voters pamphlet and including in the voters pamphlet information that's around emergency preparedness, pandemic flu, and you know, all the other disasters that we might face here in Oregon. Again, I just think we have to seize an opportunity here, and the governor being the voice that speaks to Oregonians about the importance and the with a sense of urgency about the personal responsibility role in all of this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that that there's an enormous amount of information out there, and we had spoken about that. There are lots of tools, and there are lots of very good tools. The Centers for Disease Control on their website has checklists for businesses, individuals, et cetera, schools. Once again, we can't do the planning for every business in the state. We don't have time. And every school, even though we'd like, you know, we can provide technical assistance, but access. So there's a lot of information out there. Getting it into the hands of people and having them use it. This advice that you need to keep at least 2 weeks worth of water for your family, food, medications. That's one of the things that they found in New Orleans. Once again, if you are diabetic and you know your diabetes is out of control, it may be that the hurricane isn't what affects you, and even the rising waters. But if you don't have access, having problems with your diabetes, that can be what kills you. So we need to be sure that people understand the preparedness in terms of what they can do with their family. You know, how many have an emergency plan? Tell their kids, for example, call the cousin in the next next state, and we'll all call so that if there's a huge earthquake here, you can't, the phone lines between two places in Oregon, you can't get through, but you can at least have a third party. I don't know whether families have thought of that kind of preparedness plan, and so getting that sort of urgency and what individuals need to do and what the government is going to be able to help them do and what we can't do, because I don't, you know, we don't have enough staff or resources to be able to help every individual. We have to focus on what we can do to help the community and sort of lessen the severity.
I'm going to follow up, Mr. Chair, if I may, and just say...
we're running a little late, but
this is important. I'm recommending to our subcommittee that we make a formal recommendation to our full committee that we ask the governor to declare that
emergency
preparedness day, and that we suggest language to him to include in a proclamation, and again with a sense of urgency.
Okay, we have nodding of the heads, which is a good thing.
Can I just say one
thing? Yes, Senator Carter.
What I'd like to see, and I'm sure that you guys have done some of the work with the Multnomah Health Department and under the Senator Gordon's leadership, is that this kind of a spread. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I do know about us as political leaders, and that is that we do have, and I was just saying this in the conference I was a part of in Seattle and in Denver, the one thing that elected officials do a lot, and that is to have town hall meetings. Mm-hmm. And all of us could pass these things out to the public. And that is a mode of transportation that is free and that people and elected officials are more than likely going to enjoy doing. So I'm saying if, as a state, we have this kind of written material, that would be wonderful to them. But let me be very clear. I am more concerned about us as political leaders than I am about you guys educating. I think that when it comes to jurisdictional lines, we get heavy-handed in terms of who's in charge. So I want something written, Mr. Chair, and our full committee chair lady, that I want something written down that crosses jurisdictional lines so that politicians will know who's in charge. I'm not as concerned about you guys at local levels and educating the communities as I am us. So I want to be clear about that. If we have a written guideline for this happening and the jurisdictional issues have been settled and there is an authority diagram of who's in charge, then it's clearer and people are more than likely to fall in line. That's why I like Senator Gordler's statement in terms of the governor being in charge. Because even when Katrina people came here, it was our state. I had to go into a meeting, Senator Gordley, where we had the mayor and county commissioners, and one of the commissioners from Clackamas came. And I'm telling you, Madam Chair over there, that we had to sit down for 2 hours just to decide who was going to be in charge. People were dying, could be dying in that length of time. So I'm more worried about politicians than I am educating at the local level, which is so very much important. But the jurisdictional issue must be settled before you guys can do a lot of educating anywhere. So,
as we used to say on the levee, we don't care who's in charge. Take your shovel, shut up, and shovel.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, get this.
We need to move right along. This is really great.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think, or maybe it was Senator Gordley earlier, had asked about participation in the exercise in November. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is something that we could facilitate, that we, you know, we write the scenario and figure out, I think, a discussion with you all about how you would like that to have happen, because clearly the more people who are involved, particularly, and I mentioned that as the first one, I have a number of other issues, but one of the key things was that first slide, the command, and who is in charge, and who is in charge of which area. And you're absolutely right, this mayor saying it's the governor, saying it's the feds, back to the mayor, etc. That needs to be figured out earlier. You know, is it, at which level? And of course, in New Orleans, I didn't hear much about the county, but we do have the county level here in Oregon, which is very, very, is a strong jurisdictional issue. So, yes, no, I completely agree. Whatever we can do to help that process.
The city of Portland's going to be worse. County is in charge of human services now. Mm-hmm. So city is in charge of other things.
Yeah.
It's going to be big.
of course, in the metro area, you also have metro, the regional, and a lot of the hospitals are organized around, well, healthcare systems cross counties and jurisdictional lines, of course, as well. And you have the hospital region. So, yes, it is it's quite complex out there. So, Mr. Chair, I know that we're running over. I have a few more of these sort of talking slides. You had also asked about some developing country issues. I don't know if you, what you would like me to do.
What do you think, Judith? Do you think we can squeeze it in? Do we have our next presenters here?
No, we don't.
We don't. We are okay.
let me just continue here very briefly, and I may not go through all these sort of talking slides. I'm happy to give you all access to these slides as well so you can go over them. But I think one of the things in a pandemic is that we may have a very different level of involvement early on where we're trying to diagnose the first case, where we're trying to intervene around close contacts with one case, than when 20 to 40% of the population is affected and we're having the high death rate. There may be a different role for response early on, and that may change as the epidemic goes along. And I think that's one of the things when I had mentioned earlier about decision-making points. There may be different decisions to be made early on than later. I think that in the situation in the South, in New Orleans, it's clear that you had a very disastrous event unfolding over a very short period of time, and so some of those issues came to fore. One of the things that we're really trying in a pandemic is to slow down. Even if that many people are affected, it's easier to deal with them, like hospital beds, if people are sick over a period of 6 months or even a year, rather than they all get sick in the first week or two. Then we really don't have access to hospital beds, whereas if we can slow down the epidemic, we may have more access. It may be easier for us to deal with it. So let me see. I think I've touched on a lot of this. I think that it may be of interest for you all just to look at community control measures. Isolation of people who are sick is something we already do in theory. If you're sick, stay home. I mentioned that. There's a wide variety of things where we cancel specific events. We have what are called snow days, so even in the summer you say stay home from school, stay home from work, closure of facilities or transportation. I think a couple of points to be made here is that these make sense in theory. Sounds good. Stay home, let's close down, we won't have any more Blazer games, let's say, or movie theaters. There's a huge economic impact, though, on those groups, so we need to be sure that business leaders are involved. If we go to the step of closing down public transportation, how do you get people to work? What happens? How do you keep those ATM machines going? How do people get their groceries? So I think a lot of these things may sound good in theory, but we need a really thoughtful process with how we implement them. The other point is that, and I've been to a number of national meetings on this, these seem like they make sense from intuitive. We do not know whether they work, though. I think in SARS, a number of these did work, travel restrictions, having two hospitals where the majority of cases, so, you know, if you're pregnant and delivering a baby, you don't go to the SARS hospital, you go to another one. If you have a heart attack, you don't go to the SARS hospital, you go to another one. But once again, which healthcare system here in Oregon wants to be labeled the SARS, the pandemic hospital or the SARS hospital or the smallpox hospital? We were worried about that a couple years ago. So getting hospitals on board to help us make those decisions, I think, is important.
So at this point, we have not made a determination, okay, in this region, this area, this, you know, Portland metropolitan area, who in fact will be the designated. That'll have to be developed as we go. And those plans are in place to quickly initiate that?
Okay. Yes. Mr. Chair, that we have not designated any hospital per se, but the hospital systems, and I know that Multnomah County Health Department has been working a lot with the hospitals in their region, talking specifically about this issue of what happens. And I think it may be which hospital ends up having the most cases. That's what happened in Toronto, where the spread was, and then that's how it happened, not that beforehand they said all the sick patients go here and all the patients who need sort of standard care for their heart attacks or whatever go over here. So I think that happens at the time. This is just to show that some of these things we have historically dealt with before, back in 1918. And unfortunately, although we do have the antivirals and hopefully a vaccine, I think we may be dealing with a lot of the same control measures that we did earlier. And then just, this is my final slide, and this is, we've got a new one in North America, and here you see monkeypox. This is a couple years old, but West Nile, mad cow, SARS, and avian flu is not on here. But I think one of the reasons I show this is that new diseases are going to keep happening. We don't know whether we're going to have a pandemic. We don't know whether it's going to be H5N1 or something else. So our preparedness needs to focus less on a disease-specific and more what things might we want to put in place, whether it be a respiratory disease or a diarrheal disease that's new or coming or whatever, so that a lot of these plans, we tend to think of them a little bit more as modular plans where you plug in the disease, but you still need to be working with local health departments, businesses, communities, et cetera. That doesn't change, even though the disease may change.
Dr. Chair, we need you to back up to the vaccines and antivirals. Okay. It's about five back, I think.
Oh, sure.
And we talked a little bit about that, about stockpiling and tracking, registry and allocation and distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I didn't mean, I'm just a little cognizant of the time here. In the plan itself, and I did bring copies of the plan, and I'm happy to leave the copy here, or we have these available on our website as well. In this plan itself, we basically have outlined what the priority populations would be, but doing that in general is a little bit different than doing it specifically. So I think we need to... that's something that's going to take more work. I don't have a specific slide. Let me just, I'm looking for this, the antiviral, which I can show you. I did not put it on a slide. But the priority groups, hospitalization is the highest priority group. Ill health care workers is the next priority group. High-risk outpatients, pandemic responders, but all of these in terms of treatment. Then we talk about the prophylaxis of emergency responders, health care workers, et cetera. So we have a list of priority groups. But once again, who's the priority group in October when it's starting? And do you use all your drug then? And then you don't have adequate drug for that person who gets sick in February, that's going to be an issue, is how do we then sort of prolong this. Once again, the issue in the stockpiling, there's a question mark here on purpose. We in Oregon have small pharmaceutical caches that are called, and we have those placed around, but it is not a very high number, and it's not adequate to fulfill the needs of these priority groups at all. At this point, because of the cost, we have elected not to to purchase any additional antivirals yet for our stockpile, and I mentioned the issues of that before, whether it's going to be effective, the cost for it, whether or not we're actually going to have a pandemic or whether we're going to have some other disease. So at this point, without adequate funding, we have not stockpiled any additional. The tracking of drugs right now, the federal government, too, you know, we have an immunization registry, but that's for children to make sure that they have, that we can track what childhood immunizations they've gotten. So we need some additional, I'm not sure whether it's legislation is what we need, or we need permission from the federal government who's funding that, or how it works, to actually be able to use our current immunization registry to be able to track not only adults who might be getting vaccine, mm-hmm. but what's happening with the antiviral medications as well. So you had mentioned before the question about what about tracking of other medical supplies. At this point, we're looking at our immunization registry to track the very simple issue of who needs to get a vaccine, who needs to get antivirals, have they gotten it. But that is not in place yet. That's still in the very much the sort of thought phase.
And I want to make sure that Katie is writing as she's speaking, because this is truly a question that needs to be asked.
Right.
Because that's the one thing that they found in Denver, that the allocation of dollars had to be specific to the question that you asked. Mm-hmm. And so that's the question mm-hmm. that I want asked again, so jurisdictional lines are very clear in terms of the spending of those dollars.
Well, are we getting a broadening? Because, you know, it seems ridiculous we have a resource like tracking of, you know, young people who have been immunized, but we wouldn't be able to use that to track adults, so we would know who in the process, you know, should in fact be treated, who has been treated, and that sort of thing. But the next question is, and we're hoping we're going to get an answer to that. Did those folks show up yet from the pharmaceutical question answer?
Mr. Chair, John Powell did let us know that he might be late this morning, because in my investigation, it's my understanding at this point that it's not state or federal laws or regulations that determine the personal possession of prescription medication, but instead a physician and insurance policy issue. And so he did let us know he would be arriving late, but the next set of presenters is here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
From the point of the state, a person, in other words, if you approach the doctor and said, you know, I just think for my own preparedness, I'd like to have a 30-day advance supply. So you're always rolling that into the system. You're going to be buying 30 days later once you bought the initial. Is that legal, or is that going to be, as was described, up to the doctor and the insurance company?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I actually, although it's not my area of expertise, I did, before Gary Schnabel went, he's gone now for 6 weeks, I think, out of the office, but I did talk with him at the Board of Pharmacy to ask this question, and he basically said there are certain that controlled substances, of course, they don't necessarily want to release more than a 7-day supply or whatever, but it really depends on the physician and how many they want to dispense and how many refills they're going to dispense. And once again, insurance companies, there are certain drugs that they don't, that are very expensive, and they don't want the patients to overuse. And of course, then there's also the issue of abusing certain medications, but that is not that's not governed by statute, but rather by physicians and by the insurance companies.
So this may be something, as we try to inform people, as we have our day of preparedness, that we're asking people, think about this. You know, you might want to approach your doctor, your insurance company, or yourself, just financing it yourself, because many times it would be that much money, you know, for an extra supply, whatever. If you get a 30-day, can you have an additional 30-day?
But, Mr. Chair, let's also be very real here, because we have many, many, many people, thousands of people in the state who do not have access to health care, right, who do not have a doctor, mm-hmm, who will not be able to afford getting an extra supply of medications or an extra supply of some of these other things we've been talking about.
Right.
So that thinking needs to be integrated into our planning as well. We have a lot of vulnerable people in our state.
You're
a
thinking
lot of
community supply, then, like
I'm
a mini city.
I'm thinking of whole communities of people who would be vulnerable, and if we don't give that forethought, then we have another kind of disaster, human disaster, on our hands.
One thing, Mr. Chairman, we found out that there are some people in rural Oregon that are as many as 50 miles away from a nearest hospital.
Oh, sure.
So, and
or longer.
That's right. And many of the people in terms of low-income communities do not have computers. Let's face that. One of the things, again, I hate to keep bringing up the Denver model, but that's the model I worked with, that many of the people didn't realize they had to take off the white gloves and go door-to-door in those areas where there was no level of communication in order to get the job done. So we want, in these larger communities, back to Senator Gordley's ideas that she expressed, was that we need to have planning strategies in place that deal with the people who are at least 50 or more away from the nearest hospitals, and how we communicate with the poor who do not have computers. Because a lot of people like to sit in their offices and just send out notes. That is not going to get it. That's one thing we found out about the Medicare Part D, and that's why I had become involved in this, and that is doing workshops across the country in terms of how do we get outside of our office spaces and meet the needs of those people on a door-to-door basis. You've got too many local organizations that are there to help deal with that but don't have the resources to do it.
Well, Doctor, thank you so much for being here. But before you go, we have another pilot just showed up. And one of the things that I've always used in the pilot training relative to what we're dealing with in this subject is this. About 90% of everything you do in pilot training is what to do if it all goes to pieces, right? You know, things start to go wrong. And the reason you do that, two reasons. Number one, you need to know what to do. But number two, to avoid the panic. And I think that's what we can have come out of this committee, is the fact that if you adequately inform, if we have the plans in place, you know what to do and who's going to do it, what happens is it lessens the panic, and the whole idea of dealing with the problem seems to flow way smoother. And I had that happen in an ice storm one time, and I was just thankful the whole time that drill instructor, which I used to call my pilot trainer, that drill instructor just beat that into your head. Whatever you do, don't lose control. Follow the plan. Follow the, you know, the list. So I think that's what we've heard from the committee, is this idea of making sure that we properly and broadly inform, you know, the folks of Oregon what can be done, and then for us as government to be literally preparing for you know, the scenario that we're going to have to fill in that major gap of folks. Yes, Senator.
Yes, Doctor, I just kind of want to close on this thought. In Katrina, if you had a car and gas, you could evacuate. If you had money, you could evacuate. I think in this case, what we have to be very careful of is that we don't say, fine, if you have a doctor and insurance, go to the head of the line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, you have a different kind of anarchy. You have you now have a population of people that not only don't have, but they are mad. And so I think that in Oregon, we might not have the same kind of thing as Katrina, but we could develop that same thing if we're not careful in not handling it the way that it should be handled.
Yeah. Representative Crump.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Doctor, in your presentation, do you cover the latest thinking on avian flu mutating to truly affect human beings?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator, Representative Croft, I'd be happy to also discuss or give any more information to you if you'd like.
We are being taped, so we can, that DVD will be available.
Okay, very good. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, good. Appreciate. Yes, okay. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to jump ahead right now to public facility safety design and consideration. We have Mark Long and Stacy. That's Warren, right? Warren. Now, while they're coming up, I'll kind of give you the background on this. I got a phone call from an individual in what used to be my district and is now adjoining my district. And I went to take a look at it with my camera, and what I found was very disturbing, and that is, are we preparing, are we designing our buildings to, should we be the most immune from any terrorist activity? I'll just tell you what I found. I found a large quantity of diesel, large quantity of propane, and a large quantity of oxygen in close proximity to one another. We gave a phone call in to the folks at Fire Marshal's office, and we're told, well, that's kind of common. That may be common, that may be legal, but the question is, do we need to take a look at this and possibly make consideration, because of the new times we live in, as to what the possibility of a disaster are.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Before Dr. Hedberg gets away, and as we're making this transition, I just want to acknowledge and say this on the record. We're very blessed to have the quality of leadership that you possess and that you have demonstrated and brought forward this morning. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. It was my pleasure to be here, and I'd be happy to come back and talk to you more if you'd like.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very informative. You guys have a seat. When you're ready, introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure.
Thank you for being here today.
You bet. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of the State Building Codes Division. To my right and your left, I'll have Stacy introduce himself.
I'm Stacy Warner. I'm the Assistant Chief Deputy State Fire Marshal.
What I'd like to do, and Mr. Chair, I just passed out some background information for you about our organization. Each time I'm in front of a group, I try to talk a little bit about what we do and what we attempt to accomplish at Building Codes. I'll walk you through that quite quickly. And then in preparation for the meeting, we've done some preliminary background that might be of interest to the committee, and then we'd be able to take any questions that you have. So from my perspective, if you look at my document, State Building Codes Division is the organization that adopts the construction codes in Oregon. We also license our electricians and our plumbers and that other specialty trades in Oregon. We provide a lot of training. We work with local governments. We conduct inspections in rural areas where the locals have chosen not to, and then we issue permits and interpretations on a broad basis. It's probably in our code adoption role that you have questions for us. typically what we do is we adopt a national code. There are a couple different models to choose from. Most of the states, including Oregon, has chosen one from the International Code Council for its building codes. Over the last 3 years, we've aggressively been trying to update our codes. One of the issues not only is the security that you're talking about, but also making sure that we have codes that are the same as other states, that are up to date and current. And we've taken quite a bit of time over the last 3 years to do that. As a matter of fact, right now, we're in the middle of updating our codes to the 2006 model and working with the Fire Marshal's Office on those areas. To the extent possible, we try to go along with what the national codes, making panels, recommend, so that, again, we're consistent with Washington, Idaho, California. Designers, architects, contractors working in multiple areas want to have some predictability about what they're doing, and having different standards from one city or state to the other can cause difficulty. In looking at the issues that I believe the committee is interested in, the model code organizations, the ICC and some of the other folks, have been looking at security of buildings. There's been a lot of activity since 2001, as you can imagine. Various reports out there. Most of the areas have been around improving fire control in buildings, exiting, getting people out of the buildings, fuel oil storage or storage of materials, progressive collapse, so that the buildings, if there is a failure, go in some kind of, if they are going to, instead of falling over, progressively collapse and get time to get people out. And then looking at ventilation issues, mechanical ventilation, so that you can't expose the occupants to some type of introduced chemical or otherwise. That I think our Senate had a problem with that some time ago back in Congress. Most of the work to date has not recommended whole-scale changes to the building codes to look at these issues, because each site is unique and each situation is different. What is being recommended in most of the committees that we're tracking are a series of best practice guidelines, so that designers, architects, and building owners can know about these particular areas, or also about building access prevention, whether there's retainers or security and those kinds of things. I also provided to you, because one of the other areas that we're looking at building codes is data sharing. And just an update, you may or may not be aware, there is a legislative work group on e-permitting that we're working with an interim committee on. And there are several goals of this committee, looking at how we tie the various building departments in the state together to share information. Obviously, one piece of it is the commerce side. The faster you can get permits issued, the better it is for the economy, and you get predictability and consistency. But also, and if you look at my document down at the bottom, allowing data sharing is extremely important in the times of emergency. Having access to building plans, to emergency personnel, having access to data between all the different building departments if there's a regional problem. And then one of the other key pieces that we're looking at, or that I'm interested in, is how do you get, if there is a problem, whether it's a natural disaster or otherwise, how do you get the building department or the economy back up and running quickly? Because assuming that your infrastructure goes down, you need to be able to get back in and begin rebuilding. Those time delays really cause a problem in society. And what we're watching occur in the Katrina area as well as in Florida is the infrastructure is gone, and the process of getting contractors in and building permits issued is extremely lengthy. And
I wondered if that wasn't part of the problem, because all those resources headed that way, and you kept thinking, is it a problem with getting permitting to go in and do the work?
And so Mr. Chair,
Representative Brown.
Well, now that you bring that up, I was in New Orleans yesterday.
Welcome back.
Saw this. Thank you. Saw this firsthand. How much of the city is, in certain places, is still very much devastated. A lot of little FEMA trailers sitting out in front of homes where people are living. And then there's whole neighborhoods where there no one is there, period. They're just gone. People are gone. And the homes are not being rebuilt in many places. Structures, commercial structures are not being, there's a lot of litigation going on. But it's interesting you bring this up, because a friend of mine is a national radio talk show on do-it-yourself construction. He's a contractor from New Orleans. In fact, the National Guard had to pull him out of his studio as the hurricane was hitting. He was broadcasting live. His home still has not been rebuilt 9 months later. He brought up an issue to me the other day. that is relevant to what you just talked about, and there's the issue of reciprocity. I think he told me that he thought there were only 22 states that had, for contractors, had a licensing process where you have to take a test that encompasses a number of areas. Obviously, building codes is one of them. His goal is to try to get as many states to offer reciprocity in a fairly easy and simple process. Because he brought forward the example, as part of the problem they have in New Orleans is they cannot get enough qualified contractors that have reciprocity with Louisiana in building codes to be able to do the work down there. Now, I saw this yesterday firsthand because everywhere I looked, there are signs up that say, you know, now hiring, you know, construction employees needed, yada, yada, yada. And so if we were to have, let's say, a significant earthquake event, today, the governor's office is taking part in a drill up at Camp Rylea, simulating an 8.8 earthquake and an ensuing very large tsunami hitting the coast, and how that would infect our entire infrastructure, including clear into Oregon here on I-5 and the collapse of certain bridges, so on and so forth. So we're looking at what would happen. How would we be able to rebuild? Do we have reciprocity with Washington or California contractors? Could we, assume you get through all the insurance issues, could we have, or would we rather run into the same problem they're having in New Orleans right now, where you just can't get enough contractors qualified that can come in and do the work and not provide substandard work or rip people off, those types of things? Where are we at in Oregon in terms of reciprocity? And how, if we're not there, then how do we fix that so that we can be ready for this very thing?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Croft, there are two areas of licensure in Oregon. And there is the general contractors who are licensed through the Construction Contractors Board, and then there are the electricians, plumbers, and other trades crafts that are licensed through me. On the building code side, we have statutory authority to enter into reciprocity agreements, and we have them with states currently, and I don't know the number off the top of my head, 10 or 15. One of the things on the building trade side on my licenses that you'll be pleased to know is Oregon standards are recognized as some of the top in all the other states, and so typically we do not have a problem with people recognizing Oregon. It's the challenge that we have is whether folks coming in meet our tough standards for training and education.
That's the question in emergency right there.
Exactly.
We've had electricians who say, you know, I was trained here, I moved to California, I came back, I can't get a license.
Yeah.
What would happen in an emergency?
We have the ability. On an emergency, I don't know, and I'd have to look at what kind of provisions there are to do temporary waiving and those kinds of things. But for reciprocity, we do have the ability to enter into agreements, compare standards, and get those agreements up and running in a fairly short period of time. So that's on that side. On the general contractors, I'm not that familiar, and I'd have to check with Craig Smith over at CCB to see how his program works. I know there's a National Association of General Contractor Licensing Boards, if you will, or agencies. I'm not exactly sure how they work and how they talk amongst themselves. The issue, and that's an important issue, and then complementary to that is what we're talking about with the e-permitting, is so you get your workers, but you have to have, if the infrastructure goes down and you're unable to issue the authorizations, permits, whatever, then things stall. And that's what we're looking at with this e-permitting system through this other legislative work group, is how it might benefit that particular issue. Florida has done something along these lines. They figured out that when the hurricanes come through and wipe out a small community, they're not able to rebuild because they don't even have the records or the permit techs or the infrastructure to issue the information, let alone the labor issues that you bring up. And so they've created a statewide secure system that can just be available and say, here you go. Here, now you're up and ready. You can use this system. And that's just one of the elements that we're looking at as part of this overall issue.
Representative Price.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Florida's process kind of a streamlined process? It's an online type of thing where you could, if you were an out-of-state contractor and you're interested in going there and helping out, you could go online and you could become certified online, or you would just know what standards you would need to meet to engage in certification process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp,
It's the standards for permitting, not the labor issues related to licensing. It's the standards for permitting. Again, the labor is a significant issue, but it's been my limited experience in studying these issues that it's the infrastructure as well. It's the administrative process of just issuing permits and the record keeping and the hoops that you need to go through, and that's really what I wanted to share with you, that this e-permitting, which ties into your interest, I think, mm-hmm. If there's a natural or man-made disaster, we believe that there is a model then that could be available to local government to help them get up and running quickly, because what we're told, you probably know more than I do, but what we're told, the fastest you can rebuild your city and get the city back to, or the community or the region reconstructing, it's better off for a whole host of reasons, whether they be financial, societal, economic, whatever.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When you look into the process regarding emergency waiving mm-hmm. of certain codes, what describe for us also the process that you would go through to do that. In other words, do you have administrative rule authority or statutory authority to do that, number one?
Right.
And then what kind of a process? Because what would seem to be important to me is exactly what you shared with us about what Florida's trying to do, some kind of a streamlined process whereby someone who's out of state wants to come here and help rebuild quickly, that we can be assured that they're meeting our standard, but yet it's a streamlined enough, simple enough process that it doesn't discourage them from saying, it's just too many hoops to jump through to do that. So describe for us the process you currently have, and then tell us if you think it's adequate enough, or maybe we ought to recommend some changes to it. Because the last thing I'd like to do is to have us experience what New Orleans has experienced here.
Exactly.
Okay. If we have a significant event of any type, we need to be ahead of the curve here. And if you can recommend specific changes mm-hmm. in your process statutorily to help achieve this efficiency, then let's, by all means, let's go forward with that and talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, you're exactly what we've been trying to think about in this work group. It's one piece of it. There is, and I'm going to expand our thinking into the labor workforce issues, but mm-hmm. it's exactly, you need to be ready to go administratively, issuing the permits, issuing the approvals so people can come in, they know what the standards are, they know what the work rules are, and they can get going as quickly as possible.
Can you check for us, too? You know, what you remember the last big earthquake in L.A. What happened was is that, you know, they lost a couple of major overpasses.
Mm-hmm.
Freeway system just crippled. And what happened was is you remember they cut the process down to a bare bones minimum. They got contractors in there, provided incentives. And I was driving on that thing within 30 days, and you couldn't believe how big of an overpass that thing was. And it was beautiful. I mean, it looked very well constructed. I wasn't there to see everything, but they made sure they followed procedure. But it was expedited. Can we check to see how they did that? What exactly did they cut? I'm sure Judith is writing notes right now. Because I think that, as Representative Krupp was saying, which fits, I don't know if you guys were able to hear their previous discussion, but the idea is, what authorities do we need to put in place to give you guys the flexibility to make these decisions? You know, because you can't call us back in. Well, you could call us back in a special session, but it would be nice to have this stuff in advance to where we do. Under these circumstances, trigger, and off goes the ability to deal with a problem.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to work with staff. I'm not that familiar with the roads and bridges side and kind of non-building construction practices, but I'd be happy to work with staff and Department of Transportation, looking at what California did or whoever's responsible.
ODOT, we've already asked them to do a similar mm-hmm. thing. What I'm talking about is the procedure they went through to streamline the process.
Okay.
Because I think that might be a model, and I'm sure,
sure
what's coming out of New Orleans is going to be very indicative of where we are, because if they're facing problems and we have a central data bank, you know, in Florida that's expediting their reconstruction, then Louisiana and Oregon need to be following that procedure of what to do in case of a catastrophic event.
So, Mr. Chair, the question I would have then for you in the Fire Marshal's office is I'll put the same questions to you that I have to Mark here, because you are separate, even though you do work together, obviously. If I look at your processes and procedures, if we have a significant event, And Building Codes has redefined their process to allow a streamlined mm-hmm. Process for other people to come in here, and you haven't,
then does that create a bottleneck for us, or maybe do you already have the authority and rulemaking authority, either statutorily or whatever, to be able to also make waivers and exceptions to get the ball rolling and those types of things?
Mm-hmm. Senator George, Representative Croft, members. The way the system exists currently, for new construction, the bulk of that lies with Building Codes Division. The fire aspect of that is we can provide input during that process to have our concerns addressed, but pretty much the entire process for new construction lies with BCD.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Thank you.
One question, too. I was watching a special on, you know, the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, and they mm-hmm. said one of the things that happened was they were in such a hurry to rebuild, they built back with the same non-earthquake standards that mm-hmm. they got them in trouble in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there is the idea that when we begin to rebuild, we need to kind of have plans in place for how we will be prepared for certain events. If it is the earthquake, which, you know, we had in our first meeting, the chair can retell for you the idea that we know that if that big one occurs on the coast, the ripple effect of the activity in this area will be severe. So we need to be thinking in terms of, all right, if in fact we come back with a disastrous situation, we're having to rebuild, here are the kind of the standards that we're going to operate on. And if we have those kind of planning, that kind of planning in place, that will help expedite because we don't have to, you know, reinvent that wheel.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You want to talk about the...
I think that's more of a statement than a question. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
I'm hoping, you know, because what I believe is coming out of these committees, and I just said to Senator Carter, I said 9/11 was probably the best thing that happened to this country from the standpoint of us all of a sudden recognizing that we have been very careless and not being prepared for every kind of disaster. We heard about disease, we've heard about earthquakes and hurricanes and tornadoes, you name it. It can happen. We've had the 100-plus mile-an-hour winds in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So we know these kind of things can happen. So the idea of being prepared is not a major expense, but it does require us to be thinking in terms of what do we do if. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, just in closing, again, on the standard side related to non-natural hazards, the national organizations are looking at that. There's supposed to be best practice guides that are coming out in June of this year, as I understand. We're monitoring those different organizations at the state. We feel that the 100-plus folks that are serving on these variety of committees have pretty good expertise, and we'll see how that's incorporated in the national codes, and then Oregon would adopt those if they were incorporated in. On the infrastructure pieces, we're looking at streamlining our regulations and having this replacement model up and ready, and I'll look at the labor pieces, how we can recognize licensure and contractors and those kinds of things. Are there any other areas that the committee from a building codes or standard standpoint is interested or from the fire standpoint?
Well, I think that issue of what I observed, it was a brand new hospital under construction,
mm-hmm.
and the consideration that you had, in fact, a large quantity of diesel, large quantity of propane, and large quantity of oxygen within an area the size of this room.
Mm-hmm.
And in a bowl, a basin that had been created by, they were creating a barrier from a highway, trying to do sound deadening using a dirt fill,
mm-hmm.
creating a basin behind which was all of these extremely flammable with accelerators. And my first thought was, oh my gosh, now what if this person called me? And in fact, I took videotape of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we called, we found out, oh yeah, that was absolutely within code. So my question was, is that a smart thing to do to put accelerators plus, you know, very highly flammable? I mean, you know, Judas is always saying, gosh, I'm glad you're not a terrorist. But I always think in terms of... Because I'm always thinking about, well, if I were going to attack that, I would do this. And if somebody decided to do that, one of the things we're talking about this morning, our first hearing was on, we need hospital structure that has to be able to respond to, you know, the mm-hmm. needs of the community. I don't want it on fire. I would like to have it intact. So if you had a combination of the terrorist, you know, spreading a disease mm-hmm. plus some sort of attack upon facility, do you guys believe that that standard is adequate for protection of that, of those flammables plus accelerators?
that's an excellent question, Chair. most of what's in the standards has come out of some event somewhere. The most recent example, the station fire in New Hampshire where they killed 100 people, that prompted a change in the standard, the national standard, setting a threshold for when an assembly occupancy like that needs to be sprinklered compared to what it was before. Most of the things that have come out that have been put into the fire code over time are the result of some event. Mm-hmm. In the specific example that you use at the hospital, I'm generally familiar with it. I have all the specifics, but we worked within the code, within the limitations of the authority that we have, to make that as safe as we could make it with the tools we had to work with. The chances could a single event impact all three of those products? It could, but each one on its own, I think the effect to a certain extent would be localized. I think the fire services there would be able to handle it with a minimal impact to the structure. But every situation is different. But we try within the code to make each installation as safe as we can make it.
Question.
Mm-hmm. Senator Carter.
Two questions in terms of listening to your comments, and thank you very much for those. Are, in looking at our codes, do you think our codes are strong enough to withstand any three events taking place at one time, and both of you at the table, so that's why I'm asking this question, number one. Number two, are we shortcutting because we want to build affordable housing for as well as accessible housing in communities, and so therefore people couldn't afford them if we get them earthquake ready or whatever? Because I think that that's a non-argument, that we have to have the kind of codes in place with the required recommendations for building that we possibly can, even though it might cost a little more money.
There's a couple different pieces there, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter. When you look at codes and standards, you, like everything else, you look at the risk assessments, and typically the codes are divided up into commercial or public building standards and then residential multifamily standards. On the residential multifamily standards, we do have earthquake codes in. Could they withstand everything? I doubt it. Do we recognize the national codes? Yes. Are we consistent with what, for the most part, what our neighbors to the north and to the east and the south do? For the most part, there are some exceptions, okay? And we're right in the middle of, we'll be updating our residential code here in 08. And so I anticipate more changes to come in from the national level.
Well, let me give an example.
Sure.
Because sometimes 08 is 100 years away, even though we're living in 2006. Let's think of the uneventful situation with Senator Mark Hatfield and his house falling off the edge of the where it was built. Where was his house, you guys?
It's on the coast somewhere, wasn't it?
Something's at the coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Now, somewhere along the line, building codes gave permission for that to happen in this state. And even though it's a beautiful site, even though the developers thought it was safe, I'm going to take my edge with building codes, and that your engineers are going out there deciding, well, this is safe. I mean, I just can't believe that a group of intelligent people like you guys are were given okay for a house in that particular environment, and so many years later it's falling off into the cliff. What's up?
The legislature wouldn't let them riprap.
What is that?
I think there's, Mr. Chair and Senator Carter, I'm not as
not
familiar.
Not anything you like. Oh. Pardon my ignorance here.
Big rock. Big boulders.
Jeff and I like the picture.
Yeah,
Excuse my ignorance.
You know, I think there are a couple different issues, and I don't want to try to duck your question, because, you know, the codes and standards allow folks to build. There's the minimum set of standards, but you can always exceed those.
Okay.
And many individuals and many designers and many builders do. In Oregon, what we have is a mini and a maxi standard, and we're quite proud of Oregon's model. We're one of the only states in the nation that sets that standard in all jurisdictions. So it is the standard across the way, so that we're at least consistent. We provide the same level of protection for folks in the rural areas as well as in the urban areas, where that's not the case on a national level. There are 40,000 different building departments on a national level, and there's different levels of protections for those citizens. In Oregon, it's the same standard. Now, it may be the wrong one, but we're treating everybody the same regardless of where they occupy. That said, where you locate your home or businesses tends to be a local decision, and I'm not trying to deflect it to the
local
folks, and it's based on that local site, soil, condition, exposure, whether there's an undercut bank, all those different things. Landslides come into all this. Our codes and standards, for the most part, can withstand anything that the local developers, planners anticipate, but if it's unanticipated, which I think was the case here, there was some other environmental issues that occurred, then the building could fail. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but that's the best of my ability.
In a way, but I just think that with you having a standard across the state, that makes me a little more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But when locals can go in and change that standard, that does kind of bother me a little bit, because it's a matter of safety for the people. But if you have set into place the minimum standard and people accept that minimum standard being in place, but as long as they've been advised that it's the minimum standard, then I think it's okay, because you can't save everybody if they don't want to be saved. But you can give sound advice in terms of, if this is an earthquake proof to the standard that we have in this state, then I'm very comfortable with that, because then from then on we take our own shots.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, that's exactly what the policy says, and they cannot go below the minimum standard.
Great.
Okay.
Senator Burke.
Yes, Mr. Barn, I have to tell you that Senator Carter has raised a good point, because in my district, which goes from Coos Bay to Lincoln City,
mm-hmm.
We have people building in places that I cannot believe. It is almost out in the ocean. And so someone is approving that, and there are more houses being built off a cliff. Let me, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to give you a very quick history of New Orleans.
Sure.
When the people settled New Orleans, they looked at floodplains and what was going to flood and what wasn't going to flood. If you notice, when Katrina hit, as bad as it was, the French Quarter remained intact.
That's right.
The uptown remained intact.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was damage from some wind, Tulane, Newcomb, they stayed intact. The federal government wanted to build low-cost housing. They came down and bought cheap land for the project. Down in the lower Ninth Ward, it was the cheapest land they could have. They were told it is not. People were shocked that they would put that kind of housing there. They wanted to make expressways because they had more people. The canals took the water out. That was the beauty of New Orleans. They had canals all over the city. So what did they do? They built the expressways right over the canals. So I think, back to Senator Carter's, we make decisions that are man-made decisions on standards that eventually, in a major disaster, are totally impact human life in the most serious way. And I am concerned about what the standards are for the housing in my district. In Florence, there's another whole area there that's in one of the waterways that comes inland. There's lots of discussion. And the people that are protesting that are not the people who live there. They are the people who have lived in Florence for many, many years, and they're the old settlers. And the family saying, you people are not using good judgment. So I think it's something that we need to take a look at. Just making things earthquake-proof is one thing, but where they build is another.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I would agree, where they build, not only from
from a natural disaster standpoint, but from other land use standpoints, those decisions are made at the local level through the land use planning. And once that's decided that that's an acceptable piece of ground, wherever, whether it's on a cliff or next to the ocean or in farmland, I guess, to the extent that that's allowed, then the code tells you how to build it. So it's a combination of local decision making with state minimum standards, and maybe there's some examples where that hasn't worked well, but for the most part I think it has. Just to give you a sense, this year we're going to site 30,000 new homes in Oregon, which is the first time since 1977. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of growth. My hope is most of that's going to be in appropriate places. But again, when we set the standards at the state, we provide for allowances if you're in a wind zone or in a snow zone, you're up on Mount Hood, if you're in a flood zone, if you're in an earthquake zone, if you're in a variety of different zones, and then locally they have to determine where they're going to allow people to build and not to build. Those areas are mapped and planned accordingly. And I hope I've answered your question, kind of the separation between some of the, what we do at the state for setting the standards and then some of the decisions that occur at the local level.
A quick follow-up, Mr. Kay. I want to take it from the financial point of view. If people are allowed to build in these zones where right out on the ocean, so they're obviously if we have a tsunami, they're going to be wiped away, then they're going to look to the state now to come in and help restore some of this, and they're going to look to the insurance companies to help them rebuild, which causes all of our rates to go up. Sure. So, I mean, I'm thinking from a dollar and cent standpoint, I'm personally interested in that we not do that. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I think you have a great point. It's a little outside the scope of my authority because I think this, the same issue occurs on floods in general. I mean, but from a code standpoint, from a technical of how you build it, the life safety elements of it, it assumes that that structure is going to, that the siting and all the thought processes about flooding and earthquakes and wind and snow and fire mitigation and wildland areas has all been thought through. And then the code, once you figure those pieces out, then the code gives you design criteria to build to. So I'm not sure how we solve that particular problem, but I understand it, and I wondered as a taxpayer about that myself.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's interesting, Senator Verger, you talk about building out on the ocean. When I went to Iraq, I flew through the United Arab Emirates at Dubai, and they're literally building homes in the ocean. They are about a mile offshore. They are making artificial islands and building these incredibly expensive upscale homes. Literally, it's an amazing thing to see. We flew over it on our way out. A couple of quick questions for you. Could you provide us with a list of states that do have reciprocity with Oregon in terms of either licensing or building codes issues? You mentioned you thought there was something like 10 or 15.
Yeah.
And then secondarily, especially for the fire marshal's office, getting back to Senator George's point about hospitals and the location of explosive elements, propane tanks, fuel tanks, yada, yada, yada. Do you have the authority to create a special requirements in terms of the building codes for those types of facilities specifically that are so important to emergency response, fire stations or hospitals, things like blast walls, to keep the blast or to force the blast to go up instead of out, shockwave, those types of things that don't damage the facility or even neighboring homes and so forth. Do you have the current authority to make exceptions in terms of make stricter rules and exceptions for those types of important facilities?
Senator George, Representative Kropp, no, we don't. Those would be building code elements. The codes do address, there are provision in the code under given circumstances that have those features in structures that are purpose-built, say, for that would have a potential for, say, a dust explosion or something, for explosion venting built into the building to relieve that pressure without taking down the entire structure, but to require a specific provision in this instance, we do not have the authority to require that. If they chose to, on their own, to propose that as an alternate method or material, we do have the authority to accept that as an equivalent after evaluation, but we don't have the authority to make any changes like that.
Well, we thank you too, Mark and Stacy, so much for being here. One of the things I will ask you as you guys are leaving, though, would you please kind of think about what, on the worst-case scenario, are there any things that the committee should be prepared to do as far as legislation, as far as authorities, as far as, you know, reciprocal type of agreements we need to put in place as we get ready for the next session? And I think, you know, the case is always assume the very worst thing could happen, and then when it doesn't, you're very happy. Farmers survive on that, don't they, Jeff?
Amen.
That's right. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong. Okay. Anything further? Thank you, too.
No. Thank you.
All right. At this time, we're going to have it's going to be Ken Klein come up. We're going to talk about 911 security. To give you background on this, we actually were out in one of my communities, and we were talking to some folks about law enforcement issues, and we were told that that a person would call in to a 911 center, and that would go back out by radio, including describing the individual and where they were located that had made the phone call. And the issue was, is there a secure way to do it? Because all of the druggies and the criminals in the community had the latest state-of-the-art equipment to intercept scanners, to intercept that communication. I talked to my son-in-law, who's a police officer, who has all the digital equipment in the car, and he said that's probably the most secure way to do it. But we thought, you know, when it comes to the situation of if, in fact, we have terrorist activity or we have something relatively close to terrorist activity, which is highly organized criminal activity and drugs and whatever, would it be worthwhile to have the committee talk about the idea of security of the 911 communication system? So that's what we're asking you guys to do. Introduce yourself, you know, for the record, and then proceed.
Okay. My name is Ken Kai. I'm the State of Oregon 911 Program Manager.
Larry Hatch. I'm the Assistant Director for Washington County 911 in Beaverton.
Members of the committee, my name is Ken Kime, and I am the State 911 Program Manager, the Office of Emergency Management. I'm here today to discuss the item on your agenda titled 911 Call Transmission Security. In Oregon, we've been covered by 911 service border to border since 1991, which means from anywhere in Oregon, a 911 call can be made and delivered to the public safety answering point, providing public safety services in the area of a landline caller. The concept of 911 call for services to a primary public safety answering point is the information that an emergency dispatcher uses to determine the need for a response of a public safety agency to handle the need for service. The manner that this information is transmitted to the public safety agency needing to respond to the call can be done in a number of ways, such as by radio, telephone, cell phone, or mobile data terminal. Generally, the information being dispatched over the radio system can be heard by anyone that has the equipment that is capable of doing this. The general public uses scanners which are capable of monitoring these frequencies, and lots of people listen to emergency calls for police, fire, and medical services. There are frequencies that can be programmed to be private by public safety agencies with the use of certain frequencies and privacy tones, etc. These frequencies generally are not the main dispatch frequencies used by public safety dispatch centers. Use of phones and cell phones do let calls be given to the public safety responders in the field in a confidential manner, but can take time to alert the responders. MDTs, mobile data terminals, can be used to keep some confidentiality. I just wanted to give you a general overview of how 911 calls for services are dispatched to responders and the fact that the use of radio systems can allow anyone who has the proper equipment to listen in. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have. I would like to introduce Larry Hatch, Assistant Director of Washington County Consolidated Communications Agency, will be able to also answer your questions from a PSAP perspective.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Ken's exactly right. I still remember when in Washington County we switched off from our VHF, UHF radio systems and went to the Trunk 800 system. The number of calls I took from the public upset about the fact that they couldn't monitor what their police and firemen were doing in their community. There's a large number of people out there who do that just to stay informed. And In fact, Christmas time is another time that we take lots of calls. When people get a scanner for Christmas, they want to know what frequencies they should enter into their scanners. There's a website in the metro area that somebody has gone through and listed all of the frequencies for Washington County, Clackamas County, Multnomah County. And in the trunking world, you have to go a little further. You have to do more investigation to figure out what talk groups, what numbers go to which agencies. And there's a spreadsheet there that has all of that listed out. So while there is, the criminal element can use that too, I think our community stays on top of what's going on in their areas by listening to our first responders. With that said, we do have ways to get information of a confidential nature out to our responders. In Washington County, we were fortunate enough to be the public-funded mobile data terminals in all of our response vehicles. So that's just a digital message out to that screen in that unit. We can use that. I think you hear a lot about encryption on radio networks, but every time we've looked at that, the cost has just been prohibitive for what we have available. With that in place, only those two units can hear that conversation. We do have some of that equipment available to us for special operations and things where we need to use it, but as far as trying to encrypt the entire radio network, it's we just haven't had the funding available to us.
Well, and you guys are very much advanced as compared to some of the communities, the counties, the cities that don't have, the larger resources at the Portland metropolitan area. And many of them, I'm sure they're operating old systems. I mean, we're talking tube-type radios and some of these guys. These are obviously going to be picked up by a good, high-quality scanner. Because what we were told is this is something you run down to Radio Shack, $250, your business. If you go to that website, you're definitely going to know what order to put it in. You don't have to be a high techie to figure that one out. The main thing we're thinking about is, do we need to do anything in preparedness? I mean, is there a plan in place to deal with the idea that we would have an organized terrorist attack? As we're seeing down along the Mexican border down there, where you have organized gang activity, I mean, we're talking about highly sophisticated drug smuggling units that are actually attacking the infrastructure in some of those cities. And we're talking about violent attack. So I think we need to be prepared for that type of activity. For example, let me ask just a question that will kind of smoke this out. If a person calls from a community and says, look, we have very sophisticated drug folks out here, drug producers, monitoring the phone call, would you please not communicate my name and address when you notify the local sheriff? Will they do that automatically? Are they required to do that automatically to shield that person from the exposure?
Chair George, committee members, certainly if it was that type of a report, my guess is that it would not be dispatched over the air. It would go to our interagency narcotics team by telephone and not put out over the air. So I think the way different dispatch centers handle it, I know that's how we would handle it in Washington County, though.
Are there any standards statewide?
My question, go ahead, Senator. Absolutely. My question. I have a great 911 center out in Staten, and I don't. And this is a question I need to ask them. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of years in the fire service personally, listening to calls as a responding firefighter, and. What you're talking about, it does happen, has happened. Who makes the judgment call? What's the SOP? Is there a statewide standard of an SOP for this type of thing about putting sensitive information over an unsecured radio frequency?
Chair George, Representative Koff, I don't believe there's any state standards on how dispatch centers should dispatch calls. It's all dependent on what... what the user base in that area comes up with.
Would you recommend there be standards? Because, I mean, to me, to say that if in fact this is the law that we're talking about, if a person requests anonymity relative to that notification, would it be reasonable to require then that go out to officers
and a relatively secure method. I know even the mobile data isn't totally secure, but the most secure. Any thought on that idea of that kind of a requirement?
Chair George, I've been on that soapbox for two sessions, and after getting knocked off of it the second time, I just thought, well, we'll let that go. I have a strong feeling about anonymity for people who call into 911. Mm-hmm. When they're having a trauma in their family or in their neighborhood, they're calling us one-to-one asking for help. And I don't believe that anybody, the drug dealer living next door, should be able to call me up after the cops have left and said, I'd like a tape of that telephone call right. That you just received.
So there's an issue, the secondary security relative to the communication, and then also initially relative to the response. I remember that, Darryl, now that you say that. So you would think that it would be reasonable to add that next step. That if the person said, I live in kind of a real rough area, if you wouldn't, would you not use my name and address when you notify the local police or sheriff?
Chair George, we have written into our policy, because of some issues we've gotten into, that if a citizen requests anonymity, we tell them we can't do that.
Under current law.
And if you want to stop this conversation right now, go ahead. So they may be calling in to tell us something real important, but there's only one thing that I can think of off the top of my head right now, and that's child abuse that the law specifically covers.
Mm-hmm.
I have stood in the way of people clear to the point of having to stand in front of the district attorney and have the attorney for whoever's trying to get it tell them how I'm violating the public records law. And the district attorney agrees with him, and I have to hand over the tape. I think it needs to be up to the person who called. If they want the information released, that's fine. If it's, you know, for the media, they're the ones that get upset the most. But if that person wants their 15 minutes of fame, hey, I've got no problem with it. But I think they deserve the right to say, yes, release it.
Questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think this is it's a revision that I think we need to seriously look at, especially as we try to gain a better control over the methamphetamine problem that we have, because this absolutely relates to that.
Mm-hmm.
The privacy issues of a person who is living down the block from a meth house, a drug house of some type, you don't want those drug dealers finding out who put that call in there.
Right.
Turn them in.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to try and balance this in some way. I kind of like your suggestion that the person who's making the call make that decision under the law. Currently, you don't have that flexibility, if I understand you correctly.
Correct.
What has been the objection? When you brought that bill forward, because, you know, we don't know everything in here about what happened to a bill on the way to the floor. What has been the objection? Just this idea of the media saying we want access to it?
Chair George, those were the only people I'm aware of that testified in opposition to the bill.
ACLU. Okay. And the ACLU, okay. Any thoughts on the committee on this? Because when I stumbled across this, I was a little bit shocked. I didn't realize that it wasn't secure. I didn't realize, you know, that a person could say, whatever you do, don't communicate this. Mm-hmm. And... Madam Chair?
I am. I can hear my neighbor's phone calls with a baby monitor on my patio. So
wow.
I don't know how secure we are. I'm
wow.
horrified. I
know that. Really?
There are times that I, both during when we had very tiny grandchildren in the house, that I would take the baby monitor on the patio, if my neighbor, whom I am very close to and like very much, uses their phone, it comes through my baby monitor. So I had to call him and tell him, you know, by the way, I'm going on the patio. Don't make any private phone calls. I don't want to hear them. And so I don't know what that, I don't know how that plays into this, but it's not a very comfortable thing.
Then I'm going to speak for myself, and that I hope you bring that back, and that we can talk about the idea that individual makes that phone call, being able to control that. And if, in fact, we could add to that the idea of when the person says, look, this is a bad community, I don't want my name out there when it goes out over the radio, being able to make that provision, that would be something. If you don't want to do that, we can have an amendment ready. But I think this is a bigger issue today than we would have ever thought about in the past. Too much organization and crime, and the idea that we have folks in this country right now that would like to do harm to this country. I think the combination of those two said, you ought to secure that.
And undergrounders have better equipment than those that are legally,
at least better than our state police.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Senator, you bring up a really good point in talking about digital encryption, which is widely used. Problem is our state patrol officers don't have digital equipment in their vehicles. So, many local law enforcement agencies do, but our agency, that we're charged with overseeing doesn't. So if we have encryption issues here digitally, and we're not going to do it in our new radio system in terms of radio encryption because of the cost factors involved, then I think we as a committee need to seriously look at making a recommendation for the OSP in some form.
State police need that if nobody.
Of course they do.
Absolutely.
But we've never been able to balance those issues in the legislative session in terms of the dollars involved.
Well, it still should be a goal, and I corroborate with you that this committee needs to be making a recommendation to both of our bodies regarding this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Senator Gorley.
Thank you very much, and thank you, gentlemen. I mentioned earlier that I met with the Commission for the Blind a couple of weeks ago, and they have since contacted me indicating that they have some concerns around the 911 call system, and frankly, I can't remember the detail of their concerns, but may I ask you to please be in touch with the Commission for the Blind and explore with them
Commissioner,
their issues and concerns.
Senator George, members of the Commission, sure, we'll be glad to do that. We have not been informed of any problems. We do work closely with the deaf and hearing impaired community and any other groups out there that have problems dealing with reporting issues, and so I will definitely check with them.
Yeah, we've been in discussion with the Commission around their concerns related to emergency preparedness and what they need to be doing to serve the needs of their constituency. So the concerns were raised in that context.
Sure.
And I appreciate you following up very much. Thank you.
Yes.
Senator George, Senator Gordley, thanks to funding from Ken's office at each 911 center now, we've enrolled in a process that tests our telephone system for the TDD connectivity and verifies that each one of our positions are up and running so that if a 911 call and it's a TDD does come into the system, we're able to handle it. So because of that, because of Ken's office, we have that in place, and it's a tool that, we haven't had before, and we had to, just make phone calls between 911 centers, and now every week we go through and have our system tested just to make sure that that's there. But if there are other problems, we need to be aware of that as well.
Yeah, as I recall, the issue has something to do with confidentiality, but I'll leave it up to you to explore. And again, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing also, if you guys would if you have a report on what would happen in a catastrophic event when everybody picked up that phone and dialed 911, is there a chance of the collapse? And I see there's a guarantee of a collapse.
Well, and Senator, in that regard, when we had our anti-terrorism conference up in Portland recently put on by the U.S. Attorney's Office, the lunch speaker was Deputy U.S. Attorney for New Orleans, who talked about the experience of Hurricane Katrina. And one of the key lessons, and Ken will remember this, is key lessons out of that is what worked best for them for communications were hard lines that were still working and text messaging on cell phones.
That's
when
right.
cell phones wouldn't work, text messaging would, because it requires such a lesser, capacity utilization. So That, I think, is going to be an interesting thing. You know how it is on Mother's Day?
Yes.
Seriously, you pick up the phone to call and you can't get through because the entire system is overburdened.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be like in this particular circumstance? If we did have that major event that they're talking about today and out of Camp Rylea, you know, you get this big earthquake, mm-hmm. you've got a tsunami, you've got lots of problems on the coast, but it translates. We've got bridges going down on I-5 here. We've got huge amount of problems. How do we deal with that, and what's the most effective way to deal with that?
Chairman George, members of the committee, we, the 911 committee, do look at that and do strive to try to do the best we can to make sure the system can survive or at least be rebuilt quickly enough to help us out in those situations. In Oregon, we make sure that all our 911 centers are funded for the 911 network, are funded with backup power, backup issues such as that. We also work to have all their premium circuits, emergency circuits, or what they call a telecommunication service priority system. So they are the first ones to come back up in the event of a major disaster and there's a competition to get service running. 911 is one of the ones that's going to be the first to come back up. And we also have plans between different centers around the state to help take calls, et cetera, if their areas aren't affected and things like that. But that's something that we keep up with and try to keep on with all new changes in technology, et cetera, and with all the various new things such as text messaging, which just uses very small portions of the bandwidth of the wireless. That's why those calls get through.
Mm-hmm.
So we are looking at those, and I will get that information to you.
I think that's something we would certainly want to include as we go out with education is
sure.
Just remember, if you have a capacitive text message on your cell phone, that may be your backup. That may be your source of communication.
Well,
okay, thank you.
Senator George and committee members, I was listening to your discussion during the pandemic and the public education. I think you're right on there in that we don't spend enough time doing that. I've been in my post for 20 years, and I've got a box of cassette tapes. Several of them are from these little earthquake events we have.
Mm-hmm.
And the number, our phone system is tied up from people reporting an earthquake, and I shudder to think what will happen when we have a disaster. And people need to understand that we're not going to be there for a period of time. They have to be prepared to take care of themselves, and we may get knocked down, but we're going to get back up, and then we'll be able to start helping, but they've got to get the message on being self-reliant.
The 72-hour kits are very important.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, that brings up a great question in talking about how we notify people of or public awareness and public information. If someone were to do public service announcements along these lines, reminding people you need to have a 72-hour kit, who do you call to get information about that? Is there a website? Is there a phone number where people can call to get a publication about what kinds of things could be included in a 72-hour kit?
Now, Senator George, Representative Call, your local emergency manager, each county is required to have an emergency management program. Those folks are well equipped to give you that information, and usually in county buildings, et cetera, that information is available, stairs, stuff like that. But if they last resort, they can call the state office, and we can point them in the right direction.
Okay, so it really is set up to be a county-by-county informational number?
Senator George, Representative Croft, the Emergency Management Program in the state of Oregon is basically geared around the county level, being responsible for what goes on in that county and educating, et cetera. The state provides assistance and is there to assist them in those times when they need it. And so that information is coming out from the locals to their citizenship to let them know what needs to be done, what kind of things would go into a 72-hour kit. The Red Cross, you can call them at any time. They can give you that information. And there's a lot of companies now that are actually putting those kits together. You can buy them off the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to take the time to put that stuff together, it can happen.
The discussion, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, the discussion you missed earlier was the committee identifying the need for a statewide educational campaign,
mm-hmm.
coordinated
mm-hmm.
campaign, and we're making a recommendation to the full committee.
Good. because it relates to the issue of bird flu and how do we get the information. And you, Senator Carter, you brought up a great point earlier. It was that so many of the low-income people don't have computers. They're not internet connected. So how do you get the information to them?
Senator Gordley, that Multnomah piece that you just handed, I thought it was on this one. It actually had where you could sponsor that. So a business or an individual or even a political candidate could actually sponsor that little brochure going out to their constituents. Mm-hmm. We actually talked here about the idea that, you know, we all mail out tons of garbage to you guys at election time. Mm-hmm. How about something would be useful to you? You know, you all know what we look like, and, you know, and our kids are cute and all that stuff that we do. But wouldn't it be nice if you could flip over the back of the card and it provided you with some of that basic information?
Well, I'll
and one
you.
Thing we learned was how many websites are out there that actually have excellent information on how to be prepared. And so if we could just get that information out there and for the folks that don't have the access to the web to make available things like this.
And, Mr. Chair, if I can just add, thank you very much. There is information in a similar form as that pocket guide, which is information devoted to preparing for different man-made or natural disasters. There's now a guide to preparing for pandemic flu available. And again, this is the basic information, as Senator Carter was pointing out earlier, that we want to get into the hands of every Oregonian. Well, while we've been meeting this morning, I had my staff carry a note over to the Secretary of State's office, just asking Mr. Bradbury if he would consider including in the next voters pamphlet information about emergency preparedness. So again, I think it's an opportunity for this committee to collaborate with the Secretary of State's office and that publication, which goes to every household, every voting household. And again, the community education campaign has begun with this committee.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, so Senator Gordley, good, great point. What do we currently, and I haven't looked at a telephone book in terms of some of this information, what do we currently include in telephone books? I know we have poison numbers in there, where to call, so on and so forth, but what about information like this?
Senator George, I believe some of the phone books do have information like that, but right off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you which ones.
Right.
That information comes in a variety of different things. If you belong to Blue Cross, you usually get that stuff mailed to your house as a member of one of their plans, and different groups, Kaiser, those kind of groups do things like that. So there's a lot of information out there. Like, I think the issue is people that don't have access to computers and things like that are the ones that we have to reach. And so a lot of that is being done at school and things like that, much as we've educated the young people on 911. I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find a 5 or 6-year-old that didn't quite know what 911 does at this moment in Oregon.
One thing, too, we got a really very nice piece. I don't know if each one of you got it in your office from Marion County. And it's, you know, you turn the little dial and you read down the little section. Have you seen that? It looks like an old pilot's computer. But anyway, the thing about it is I was looking at that, I said, I wonder if we can just take that stuff and reprint it. And we look down the bottom, it's copyrighted. So we need a generic information set. In fact, we called Multnomah County to make sure that we could duplicate what they had in there. So we need to have stuff that we know that we can tell someone, you know, put that in your church bulletin, put it in your meeting, whatever's going on, hand that out to your folks. You're perfectly free to duplicate it.
Yes.
I think that's something we need to consider as far as this communication, making sure that it is generic enough, that it complies to everyone, but yet it doesn't have any copyright on it, and that everyone can duplicate that any way they see fit.
That's right.
All right. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Next issue we're going to be dealing with here in a hurry is going to be this idea of regional and local access to pharmaceutical supplies. And you heard that come up in here a little while ago about the equipment, antiviral supplies that might be available, and this issue of pharmaceutical supplies. Come on up, you guys. It's really critical, and we're trying to get a handle around what are the limitations. So I'm hoping you guys will be able to help us with that. You guys know the drill. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed as you have chosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Lario. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm not sure we're going to be a lot of help to you today in terms of an answer, but we can explain the way the current system works and how it probably isn't designed to address the problem that you're concerned with. On the insurance side, I'll just say a couple things very briefly about what is typically in insurance contracts in terms of coverage of prescription drugs, and a general observation about how the mechanism could or could not work in the context of an emergency. And then John can give you a lot more detail on some of the, basically, I think, obstacles to using a private insurance mechanism for this purpose. In today's marketplace, if you have group coverage, especially large group coverage, you're going to have a pretty good prescription drug coverage. That's the where risk is pooled in a large pools, and the insurance mechanism works best. As you get into small groups, there's less coverage, but probably still 75% of small group plans have pretty good prescription drug coverage in them. As you get into the individual market, there's probably only about 20% of plans that have embedded in them a prescription drug coverage. There are usually, and I think almost always with individual plans, an option. You can add on a prescription drug benefit. The other thing that's common today in insurance plans is that there's a lot more cost sharing with prescription drugs. So a typical plan would have, like, if you buy the brand name drug, if you buy the generic drug, you'll have a fairly low copayment. If you buy the preferred drug, so low copayment would be $20 or 20%. If you buy the preferred drug, it may be twice that, $40 copayment. And if you buy the fancy brand name that you saw on TV, if there's an alternative that works, that brand name may be $60. So there's we have a couple plans that we mandate that the carriers offer to people in the situation where they lose their group coverage, and the one that's designed to be equal with the market has roughly the numbers I just said, $20, $40, $60 cost sharing. The one that's low benefit level, so designed to be kind of at the minimum level of the market, on top of all that, it has a $1,000 deductible, meaning you have to spend $1,000 out of your pocket before you get any coverage. So that's kind of roughly what is provided in these contracts. Generally, the insurance companies, we don't regulate this. There's no mandate to have prescription drug plans, and if you do have them, there's no mandate on exactly how they should be administered. John and I were talking beforehand, and I think in general, most carriers would allow you to buy most situations, you know, a couple weeks or 30 days worth of protection, and he can explain some of the reasons for that. None of that's required or prohibited or anything. It's a matter of the contract between the two parties. There isn't any requirement. If somebody comes in and wants a stockpile, likely under a normal contract, that's not going to be allowed by the insurance company. And with that, I'll turn it over to John to explain some of how that works, and then we can go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powler, represent Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. As Mr. Ariel pointed out, it is correct that there are limitations in terms of the quantity of drugs that an insurer, in almost any case, will allow a person to buy at one time, and there are many, many reasons for that. One of those, obviously, is resale for certain drugs. If a person could get enough of them in advance, sell part of those and that sort of thing with people without getting prescriptions. But the most important reason for that kind of management is cost. For a while, pharmaceutical costs were the fastest growing element within the medical field. I'm not sure that's true now. I think hospitals may have taken over not only as the largest expenditure, but also maybe the fastest growing again. But one way of managing that cost is to make sure there is no waste in the system. People change pharmaceutical prescriptions quite often, particularly people who have multiple prescriptions, which is almost all of us. I was shocked once to read how many prescriptions the average American has. It's 5 to 7 prescriptions. And I thought that was odd until I went home and realized that's how many I have, and I'm healthy. But I have one for acne, one for this, one for that, one for this. And pretty soon I was there with the average American, and I have no chronic disease. So because of this interaction, if people have multiple months of supplies of these drugs, if they're taken off from that drug, those are then flushed down the toilet and wasted, and that pool of insureds then have paid for that and that waste. There are mechanisms where people can get advanced prescriptions paid for through their insurance plan if they're going to be gone on an extended trip, something like that. Or the preferred way, if you have a chronic disease, is to purchase through the mail order, and those are available in 3 months' supplies. You're still going, even though you buy them for 3 months at a time, there is going to be a point in time when you don't have a 30-day extra supply on hand.
Mm-hmm.
So if you took all of the pharmaceuticals that are being purchased by people who use them regularly, it would be a lot of money to double the amount of prescriptions purchased at any one time. So instead of getting a 30-day supply, you could get 60. And we had that priced because there have been proposals in the legislature to allow 90 days of purchase, and though for convenience sake, and we have had that price. I could not get that information quick enough to get you what it would cost to go to 30 days or 60 days advance, but we could get those figures for you in terms of what it would cost at least the Regent's Book of Business.
A couple of years ago, Senator Courtney and I were at a meeting, and we had the pharmaceutical companies in there, and they were talking about the whole distribution system and how this whole thing worked. And one of the and of course, many of the pharmaceuticals, as you guys well know probably way better than I do, they require, you know, temperature, humidity. There's mm-hmm. certain things that have to be present in order to store these things. The question that I had was, do either of you know what kind of quantities are in a given area? Because today, so many industries are very much like Walmart. Well, I mean, you're basically manufactured for tomorrow's shelving. And, I mean, they're in transition. They're being transported from one place to another. What about pharmaceuticals? If we have, as Representative Krupp described, we have the loss of a couple of major bridges. We have airports that may be closed because of certain circumstances. We don't know what happened to the runway. I know we can get these things fixed quickly. Do you guys have any idea how rapidly we can backfill the needs of the folks in a disaster?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't have an idea of that. When you state it in that sense, it does become, I think, a public health issue as opposed to an insurance issue on how you would deal with a population who is stranded in those situations. And I don't know what happened in Katrina, more so because people were transported long distances away mm-hmm. from their area. The doctors were gone. The hospital was no help. I mean, they would have to seek help wherever they went to. And in case of large congregations of people, they don't have transportation. They didn't have money.
Mm-hmm.
It became some kind of a public health issue, and I don't know what they did. I assume that there was some effort to get people in. And as I recall at the Astrodome, there were people who were short of insulin, and one of them was shown to be having a seizure. Somebody else's insulin, I think, was used.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it absolutely would be an issue to look at.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple thoughts on that. I think if you look at it in terms of now this stranded population and how do we get them the supplies they need,
right.
I tend to agree with John that that's probably best thought of as a public health issue and not an issue to think about the insurance companies working with one by one with people to make sure that each of them is individually stocked. So I think that probably makes sense, especially if you're thinking about the most common drugs. Insulin is the obvious example where you have a 10% of the population or something that needs that. You know that that's pretty much the right drug for that situation.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that drives you back the other way is this cocktail of drugs that most people take, and you have to know know your own drugs and how they interact. And so you think about that from a public health side, someone kind of trying to rush in with, you know, the 10 most common drugs from a public health perspective and then figure out which people are supposed to get which ones, you know, that drives you back to the insurance side of the equation, and maybe people really need to have their individual cocktails of drugs. But it does strike me that if you tried to put some mandate on insurance companies in this way, that you would be dealing with the solution might work for the one case where you want it to, but it might have 10 undesirable mm-hmm. consequences on the other side at the same time.
Mr. Chair?
Well, yes. Go ahead, Representative.
John, you mentioned that you get 90 days on a prescription online.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, you can, through mail order, most normally get a 90-day supply through that mechanism.
Why would they allow it that way, but I can't do it from Gold Beach? I mean, that is the thing I fight constantly if I'm not home, and I can't get my high blood pressure, yet I'm going to be gone longer than what the supply is I've got. So I'm mailing it to different addresses or I'm... My wife's prescription is the same prescription, so I'm using her pills till mine get there. It seems like if a doctor was going to tell you that you're going to use that, it's been successful for a year and you're probably going to be on it the rest of your life, why couldn't that be increased? Because there, you're not going to have waste if it was backed up by a doctor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, again, the mail situation... because of the time lags in both ordering and receiving and any interruption that may occur in that system, to do it on a 30-day basis would cause even more frustration than trying to find your pharmacy in your travels. So that's why the different length is allowed in that as a convenience. It is possible to, if a doctor will write a script for 90 days, insurers could pay for them. But it would be difficult to create a system that did not need to be updated almost continuously because new drugs coming on the market, which ones would be susceptible to this and which conditions, and then to treat people fairly. Where some people were getting 90-day scripts paid for and some were getting 30-day scripts paid for. So I think that administering that is problematic if you're going to be fair to people in all situations.
Thank you to you very much. Well, Judith is going to work on this idea of, you know, what is the level of what is the mechanism for distribution, and the concept of is it a reasonable idea that a certain supply would be present in Oregon if it would be rotated through the system? In other words, excuse me, would be made available to low-income folks after it's been, you know, stored for 60, 90, whatever the recommended time is. It may be more complex than it's worth, but I sure think it's worth looking at because it's one of those issues that when we first thought about it, we said, oh, my goodness sakes, what would happen, particularly with the coast, because the coast could be isolated for a substantial amount of time, a lot of senior citizens on the coast, and so you kind of worry about those kind of issues.
No, Mr. Chairman, it's always... dangerous to speak for another state agency, but my guess is that the public health people are the best people to talk to about that particular issue.
Yeah, we think so, too. Great. We appreciate it. Anything else to come before the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A couple of requests. Thank you. I've had a chance to review a couple of documents that we were presented with this morning. One is the document from NCSL and the information on... pandemic flu. There's a table here that shows federal funds for state and local pandemic planning that indicates that Oregon is receiving $1,366,765 for state and local pandemic planning. I would like to see, information on how those dollars are being spent, where and how those dollars are being spent. And then we also have this other document that is the state and local pandemic influenza planning checklist. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to see the checklist with some check marks on it.
yep, we are.
So we
yep.
know where we are.
Where, yeah.
What progress?
Yeah, this doesn't do you any good. What progress have you made?
So whoever has could take responsibility for doing that would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, because that is the real danger that
is
we
that
all
you,
go
Tom?
Through. And we have nice units of paper.
Is that you? Okay.
We have nice units of paper that no one has checked and no one has actually made the preparations.
Yes, yes.
And we all do that.
Yeah,
I mean, how many people with their own automobile don't follow the operator's manual when it comes to oil changes and the rest of it? All right.
Sadly, too many.
Mr. Chairman.
If you're during the warranty period.
Before you all leave, we need to deal with the July the 13th in Portland. Is our next meeting.
Okay, well, can I tell you something else?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if they won't bring it to us, then I have them to bring it before my committee and then invite this committee to come.
Okay. That's good. That's right. Okay, don't forget the meeting this afternoon, right?
Right here?
Right.
Well, same.
Right
yep, same place. Yep. And with the tap of the gab.
July 13th.
Okay.
July 13th.
13th.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In Portland. Now, do we know the location? Is it OMSI?
OMSI is full up with kids' camps and stuff like that. They don't have any rooms. So probably at the Port of Portland. We have rooms available at the Port of Portland.
Okay.
All
right, and we'll be notifying everybody.
Okay, either if you don't want to do it there, we can always do it at Kaiser.
Okay.
Or the state office building.
Well, we are going to be dealing with port security issues, so that might be a good...
Right, so just let me know how I can help.
Okay.
Thank you.
With a tap of the gavel, we'll be adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.